department led by the minister, officials from parliament, officials from department. Let me take this opportunity to welcome you to this meeting. I will then request that we observe a moment of silence for meditation or prayer. Thank you very much. I'll take this opportunity to once again welcome us, all of us from the recess. This is a short year, and we have a huge agenda to finish within a month, and I hope we have enough rest and we have energized ourselves because we have to run with speed and be able to close the sixth parliament. I'm told that we might rise by the end of March, but it will depend by the president's announcement on the date of the election. We have done much in the previous financial year, or the previous year, because the financial year is still on, not finished. But we have the financial year, which is 1 month, that we have to conclude the sixth term of parliament. With that note, we'll acknowledge the apologies for those that have not managed to come to the meeting. This is our first meeting of the year. Apologies.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to the members. Good morning to the minister and the colleagues from the department. Chairperson, I received an apology from Mr. Malachi, Ms. Hwai, and Mr. Malimaja, also Dr. Mkize and Advocate Masoda are running late, but they will join us late today. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Those are the apologies, and we have an apologies for Minister, sorry.
Thanks, Chair. We did communicate. I'm not so sure why it didn't reach the Secretariat. I requested to come for 30 minutes because it's a cabinet day to go back, precisely because my deputy minister can't come to the committee. She's got a family bereavement, and those were the two apologies from my side.
Thank you, Minister, for that. Will that now introduce ourselves? We have a new member. We'll give the minister to introduce the DG before I introduce members of parliament to the DG, so that he must start to know whom he's talking to. Minister.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Good morning to you. Good morning, Honorable members, colleagues. Thank you very much, Chair, and also for your indulgence. Yes, indeed, we have, as we committed previously to the Portfolio Committee, appointed the Director General for Human Settlements, who started in January 2024, Dr. Alec Mwemi, sitting next to me, Dr. Memi's experience is quite vast. I think we'll share fully the profile if members need. But just to indicate, within the National Seal of Government has been an accounting officer full term for two departments. Department of Sports, Arts and Culture for full term, finished his term there. Department of Transport, full term as a DG there, but also has more than 20 years experience as an executive, senior executive within the state, both province and national, and also youth, its youth commission previously as well. In terms of academic spread, as you can hear, I said PhD, in terms of work, he's also in the process, acted in labor, acted in public works, but also head of Infrastructure South Africa, and also property development companies in the DPWI portfolio. So a person who has experience as an accounting officer, but also as a senior manager in government, and as well in terms of qualifications, quite a vast experience within the infrastructure space, and that's why we have appointed him and looking forward to the work that he has to do. Chair, that's the Director General, so but in full. I've really summarized it, but he's got more than 20 years in terms of senior management in government, and I must say, Chair, with no record of any allegations against him. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister. Let's take this opportunity to welcome you, DG, to the Portfolio Committee on Human Settlement. We are a committee of 10 members. But for now, we'll introduce those that are here. We had apology of Mr. Malachi, who has traveled to Russia. And then we have a quick note of Honorable Sekwai. Then in the house, we have Honorable Harold. And then we have Honorable Seki. A naughty old man, so we must expect the drama. And then we have Honorable Makasene, and then we have Honorable Mpiti, and then we have Honorable Dr. Kumar, and then Dr. Mkize and Advocate Masuta, they'll join us, they are still on their way. Honorable members, in terms of the agenda, today we'll be dealing with the briefing by the department on the white paper. We know that the department is engaged with the white paper on human settlement, which we were briefed, but we just thought we needed to be briefed more so that we can become part of the process. Even when it's our turn as the portfolio committee, would know that what are the issues and how as the portfolio committee will then be able to position ourselves to support the department towards the finalization of these policy, and then two, we are supposed to, in terms of our program, we're supposed to receive the briefing by the minister on the title deed restoration program, since it has been elevated as the priority, last year you'd remember that we were supposed to have a meeting with National Treasury. And National Treasury actually referred us back to say that actually in terms of presidencies, they've appointed the minister to head it. But the minister has indicated today is the cabinet day. She will have to leave. We'll organize the other day for that meeting so that you have enough time to engage with the the team. Operation what?
Operation.
Oh, Operation Vulindlela. So why is Operation Vulindlela? We'll get it in that that meeting. Then we then put remove that item because the minister might not have enough time, and then put the one for the briefing, which two were supposed to. We've agreed that we needed to be briefed on the accreditation framework for the municipalities to administer national housing program. So those are the two issues that we'll deal with, and then we'll then have deliberations, and we'll then deal with the program, because already it has been amended, presented to yourself for adoption again, and the minutes of the previous meeting, and then with the meeting closed, and then I'll then move for the adoption of the agenda, get the members to move for the adoption of the agenda. Honorable Harold?
Chair, I propose we adopt the agenda.
Can we get the seconder? Honorable Seki? Thank you very much.
No, I was looking for where my address. I'm looking at the Harold is sitting on the front. He was preparing for 2024 outcome.
That's what I said to my respect.
I feel conscious.
Okay. No, thank you very much. I think Honorable Harold, you can just receive it. Those are the blessings from the old man. That day I received. Yeah. Okay, thank you very much. we'll now hand it over to... And let me take this opportunity to welcome the stakeholders. I can see that we have visitors here. Maybe just to explain to members, I was called, I don't know, the chair who has called me is part of the meeting, because seeing the agenda, they wanted to get me to come and receive the memorandum, and then memorandum and the petition, and then I start to then explain what is the petition and then the memorandum, how we handle them in Parliament. so the process has to go through the Speaker before I can just receive the memorandum, because it's the Parliament process. So I suppose there might be the group just to come and listen what we are dealing with. Of course, it might be the issues about the white paper on human settlement. They thought that already the processes are such that now it's coming to Parliament. So they and I've explained that, you know, it's the committee has invited the department to come and brief us. The process is part of consultation. Honorable Harold?
Yeah, I just wanted to maybe just in response to that say, just for the record, I was also asked to collect the petition and memorandum. So I collected the petition and I will handle it in terms of the rules of the petitions.
Okay. So I've explained to them how they should do it, and then we'll then we'll then attend it as a petition. And I told them, I've workshopped them that if it's a memorandum, it can just then be left in the files. But if it's a petition, the record of Parliament that can, even we've left, it can then continue to to be engaged by the coming committee, or if we're still here, we'll continue to engage that petition. So I hope, is it the group? Okay. Yeah, so now you're welcome to meeting. Our meeting is open for public. Feel free to, but you can't participate, unfortunately. can just listen, and then outside the meeting, then you can then start to talk to us until you are being invited officially. You will not allow to participate. So with that note, I will then hand it over to the minister to introduce the issue, and then you will then delegate those that are presenting, and then you are released at the time that you want to be released.
Thank you very much, Chair. let me do a proper introduction of the delegation. I introduced only the DG, as I said, next to me is the Director General, Dr. Mwimi. Next to Director General is DDG, Ms. Dumalisile, who is responsible for affordable rental and social housing in the department. So the work around accreditation of framework for municipalities is under her, leader branch. And then next to her is DDG for policy, strategy, and planning, DDG Dr. Mhlongo, whose work on white paper policy falls under. And then next to Dr. Mhlongo is Director, Mr. Mialani Ndlemo, whose work is on the framework. And then we've got, you know, the PLO of the minister, the PLO of the DM, Xolelwa Makhazi, they are sitting right at the back, and also DG's PLO, Milile, who's here. And then I've got my media liaison officer, Hlengiwe Ntlabathi Mgodi. Chair, maybe just to start with that, we started drafting the white paper policy review last year. We did come to the committee first in the first form of a draft. Before we went to cabinet, we received substantive comments and input from the portfolio committee, and we inputted in that. We then consulted based on government structures, SALGA, the provinces in terms of MINMEC, our sister departments, and then we went to cabinet process for cabinet to approve the white paper so that we can go for public consultation. We then held an NGO summit last year in Gauteng, where we called NGOs to come and engage with us. It was a two-day workshop type that we were able to talk to them and present the white paper. It was out of those that some of them started raising the concern around the closing date, which was going to be in January, end of January, for public consultation. And we started saying, we'll look into it, let's get submissions so that people can be able to input. We went to the National Council of Traditional Leaders in consultation. They've asked us to come back as well in their consultation process to input in the issues. We're currently as well going in province by province where we have Imbizo, engage with communities around what the white paper says. We've done in Kabeja myself, besides just at the ministerial level, we've done together with the DM at Kabeja, we've done that. We've done in Mpumalanga, this week will be in KZN, to do as well part of the consultation. And as we go, we'll look into the areas. Or we've done as well explaining of the white paper even in Gauteng. So we've done Gauteng, we've done Kabeja, Eastern Cape, we've done Mpumalanga, we've done, we are doing KZN, we'll look into the other areas. What we're doing is more around just ensuring that there's outreach in terms of white paper and also engaging in the public domain. You know that statutorily or legally, what the white paper policy is required is for us to issue it as a notice in the Gazette, and therefore people make inputs within 30 days, it's closed. But we understood as a department that it's very critical for communities to understand the policy at this point in time and not just rely to those who will receive a notice and then make for formal written submissions, but also for us to take it to our communities as an outreach. I've been saying to the team as well, it's important for them, even beyond the minister, just to do some of the engagements. So there are platforms that are done provincially as well by technical team without the minister. in engaging, utilizing the platforms of councillors, utilizing the platforms of MPLs in the provinces so that we can be able to reach out to many stakeholders. So we're working together with the provincial departments to ask them to coordinate stakeholders that would be. This morning I got a reach out from the academia. They felt that just writing is not sufficient. They've asked me to, they want me to be a part of the engagement, not at the technical level, which I've agreed. We'll do that before the end of the month as well. A hybrid model of the academia, where we'll engage with academia that are practitioners in the sector so that we are able to deal with those issues. So I thought, let me just clarify the process in terms of engagements and what we are trying to do. Chair, once we receive all the inputs, and that's why I was saying, even here Monday I was meeting with the NGOs in the Western Cape who wrote to us. One, they raised the issue of the deadline initially to say that January was not, that's why we extended to end of February. Compared to 30 days, we've passed 30 days of consultation. Secondly, it was the issue of the language, that we need to translate it into other official languages, which I think the team will deal with that as well. And then the issue for us now, Chair, what is coming through, it's, I can say, competing issues. One, on the issues around beneficiaries, just to give them, take you through what is there, but based on our experience or what we are coming out, I just thought it's important for me to flag them. The issue of beneficiaries is coming strongly, one around where you have people who are saying, in the new policy, please prioritize the senior citizens more than the youth. And then the youth have come strongly to say no. But these people, when you give them the houses, literally, you're giving to an 80-year-old who then passes away and the house is benefited by a younger generation or their grandchildren. So is it not different? We, like, you're discriminating the other youth because they do not have senior citizens in their households. So it's coming as a contradictory or competing issue. The second issue is around women who, for example, around GBV, you would understand that we flag that. We do believe that it's a genuine case that we must accommodate in the policy. Where you find that, because the current policy says if you've been a previous owner of a property, or whether land or anything, you can't benefit, for example, on the PNG RDPs. Now, they are saying, if I have been a co-owner in my household with my husband, and I'm facing the possibility of femicide, I run away. Shouldn't government then not treat me like any other person, but also make a provision? But the issue there was more around, how do we protect this from abuse? How are you going to see that this one indeed is a gender-based violence victim compared to just any other person? So it's that. Then there was an issue around, which came as well lately, the issue of women who are also in divorce or divorced, where somebody was sharing an experience that, for example, I would have been on a permit after being married by my husband, but we were staying in a family home of my in-laws. As I walk out or we divorce, they tell me that, but you don't have ownership of this house because it's a family home. You were a daughter-in-law in this family. Therefore, when you leave without the ownership of the property. And then they say, but when I come and apply, then I appear as previously having owned a property. So there's two things around communication, information sharing, but also alerting people, obviously, going forward, what the implications are in terms of that. The other issue that comes through is around foreign nationals who are in the country. You do have illegal immigrants that do not have to qualify. And then the issue is on emergency housing. In terms of international standards, when you look at emergency housing, what is done globally is that other countries put a time frame to say, okay, if there's a natural disaster and everybody has been affected, whether South African or non-South African or citizen or non-citizen, you provide for 72 hours accommodation. After 72 hours, those people should be able to go and find. You do not have an obligation as a country. It's a policy gap in the country. We do not have such. So we do not provide to say this has to be provided. So you find that in other areas, then communities fight to say you are providing shelter for foreign nationals. Others would say, then the NGOs will take us to court to say, but you have an obligation based on international law. So we thought that is something that we must close in the policy gap to give certainty and actually for all the spheres of government and everybody to know what is it that we are all supposed to do. The issue of also selling of RDPs comes into effect. Somebody says, you are saying, Minister, to us that these are economic assets in our hands. You give me an RDP, which is worth 350,000. You give me a title deed. The minute you give me a title deed, it's no longer your property as government. Therefore, you need to walk away. And whether I sell it or I don't sell it is none of your business. Current legislation says you can sell after 8 years, but government has to have the first right of refusal. In practical terms, Chair and Honourable Members, it doesn't happen. Since I've been in the portfolio, I've never had somebody say, we want to sell RDP, do you want it back? I've never had, since 2021. But you get stories as you go into communities that they are being sold. And when you find, indeed, the person has sold after 8 years. Now, do you go and get them arrested? And with police, they say, but you want us to arrest, they're dealing with a murder case. And those are the issues that we have to deal with policy-wise. And I was saying, what is the practical way of putting policy in a manner that is implementable, is easy to not to cause problems? So it's those things. Then the other issue that has come through strong is the issue of that as government, when we do policy, we don't do policy for public sector only. We do policy for even private sector. So the explanation now says, those who are in distress says, I buy a house through a bond. It's a 20-year bond. I pay for 19 years. After paying for 19 years, on the 20th year, I lose my job. Maybe left with less than 100,000 or at 100,000 of my bond, having paid 3 million already. Surely there should be some level of protection rather than the bank repossessing my house and selling it into the market. Now, some of the proposals that are coming through is to say, shouldn't the department then put a clause or some legislative mechanism that forces the banks and the private sector to have a assurance or insurance or some level of protection on that capacity? For example, if a person loses an income, therefore they have a protection of loss of income to be able not to lose their property. So that's another gap that they found. Then the other issue that came strong as well, just to flag it, it's the issue of we currently provide for social housing in terms of rental. There's a strong push for rent to own that we currently don't have and don't provide as government. But also others were saying, so SHIs, for example, social housing institutions are building. But if you look at in terms of the micro level, there's quite a number of people who can build better, quicker. Can you provide an alternative or a mechanism of support in that area? It's a very complex issue because this is the area where you deal with the backyarders, those who are doing rental in the backyard. If you go to rural areas, especially like your Mpumalanga, you find that in the yard somebody has built like quite a number of rooms at the back, and then they are renting it out to the mining communities. So they are saying, are you not going to provide for such support? And the issue then as well is that you don't want to do too much policy that becomes unaffordable in terms of expectation. But those are some of the things, Chair, that are coming through in terms of some of the inputs that we are receiving and we continue to receive. Our target, Chair, is to have the policy approved by Cabinet before Cabinet rises for elections. Initially, our intention was to say, can we have the policy being approved before the 1st of April? It doesn't look practically possible currently with the extension, because obviously you still need to go and ensure that you incorporate everything that you have received into the paper, and also it must go through cabinet processes. Just between the DG cluster and cabinet committees and cabinet is literally a month. So we're definitely going to overlap to April. Our our target is to at least by end of April, not in May, because we do think that if it's in May, then we're risking that the policy will not be approved by that time. That will lead to the review of housing code and then the act, which will then come to Parliament. Yeah, last point, which has come through as well strongly, which that's why some of these policy changes are important, is the issue around even National Treasurer and Auditor General saying even what we want to do quite effectively, where we've seen the gaps in management of our grants, we are not able to do that because the policies don't allow us. So that's why the policy changes are important. The issue of qualifying, people say the cost of living has gone up. You are continuing with 3,500 as a minimum. Whereas if you look even a food basket in a household, is about 3,500. So there's a push from communities to say change your qualifying to at least 5,000. We can't do that currently because it's within the policies already stipulated. So that's what I just wanted to say, Chair. The experiences that we do would continue to appreciate when members send their inputs, when they are in their constituencies, send us written comments so that it enhances what we are working on. And that's why we appreciate this platform, Chair. And those outside, I mean, even the team that are talking about a memorandum would like to know what are their issues so that we can take, I think the team can take also some of those issues. It doesn't have to go through the petition process because we are working on this. We can just receive the issues that they are raising so that we ensure that they are incorporated into the white paper process because we are currently in the consultation process. So the team will definitely interact so that we make sure that even while you are going to do it in the process of Parliament, it doesn't arrive to us too late to be able to incorporate it. So with that, Chair, thank you very much. And as I requested, I will request to go back into Cabinet so that the team can be able to proceed. Where there is a need, definitely commit to coming with the presentations as we agreed. I think we scheduled for next week, if I'm not mistaken, will definitely come through to the portfolio committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Minister. As I've said, you are released, and then the DG can then take it over now.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thanks to the Minister for the background that she has given and the important context to which the white paper is being rolled out on and the processes that are still unfolding. Just to indicate that we have extended the timelines to the end of this month, February, to still allow for those that may not have submitted any written comments to do so in the process. And the Minister is correct in terms of the characterization of the key issues that are currently emerging from the white paper process. And one needs to then indicate, Chair, that our intent, though, does not only end with the white paper process, inadvertently and dependent, obviously, on what comes out of the white paper. And if they are far-reaching, as we have seen some of the inputs that we are currently receiving, if they are indeed far-reaching proposals that would impact on the current housing code, particularly on the norms and standards, some of the matters Minister has raised speaks to the issue of the criterion that is currently embedded within the housing code. This would inadvertently mean that the code may need adjustments to suit with the current policy trajectory. And equally, for those far-reaching proposals that do not find resonance with the current provisions of the law, the National Housing Act would inadvertently require that harmonization be done, and therefore the onward-looking process of possibilities of amendment to the law.
Can you set a closer to a minute?
Okay, thank you very much. And as I was indicating, inadvertently we may have to revisit the key tenets of the code as well as possibilities of amendment to the law to harmonize so that there is a clear articulation of what we are saying from a policy perspective and what the enabling provisions of the law would have to be to enable us to achieve what the current policy trajectory seems to suggest. And I think just to add on some of the key issues the white paper policy brings into being, which the minister had not covered, but which I think needs to come to the fore even before Dr. Mkhongo gets to present to the members on the process that we are undertaking and where we have been and where we are going to finalize the process. The important part is that we are bold enough ourselves as a department to put it out there on the things that we envisage should actually become the new policy trajectory. We do so imbued by the experiences we have had in the governance process and the weaknesses we have identified in the system, and also given the number of complaints and the number of challenges that have beset this sector for quite some time. And we are also alive to the challenges of capacity we have seen within the sector and how the instruments that have been embedded within the sector have evolved over time, and why we are still having sticky challenges to address some of the challenges that are there. One of the boldest proposals we are putting out there for communities and society to discuss is on the issue of the introduction of the human settlements on ombudsman or ombudsperson. And this speaks to our ability to hold ourselves accountable, first and foremost, as a soft mechanism compared to the difficult processes of litigation and even petitioning, as you may see. It's a tedious process, whereas with the ombuds exist, the ombuds is in a position better to respond and to more easier mechanism for people to lodge their complaints and for those complaints not to fall within the cracks and to be dealt with. Currently, our experience is that even in our engagements with other chapter man institutions, this will be better served by a standalone ombudsperson, as was the case with taxation matters, that they had to be removed from the role of the public protector and the human rights commission and so on, simply because of the sheer size of numbers that are involved in this picture. And therefore, we think that there is a case to consider this and the white paper for it to provide this. And Minister spoke to this, but I want to elucidate it quite well, the issue of our openness to the amendments of Section 10A and 10B of the Housing Act. And I think we think that this has had its own successes in preventing undue and illegal transfers of property built by the state into private hands that easily. And however, we are also cognizant of the fact that the transfer of the properties into the hands of ordinary citizens who are beneficiaries seeks to empower them economically, and they have economic leverage on which they can then utilize to alienate property and to actually utilize it for economic leverage to transact, to participate in the economy, to access loans, to participate fully in their own well-being in this regard. But it has to be balanced out, and we have also seen that banks are quite shy because of these provisions, particularly the provision of the right of first refusal by the state. And the state becomes a dominant player at which it can buy at what it wants to buy, and it relies on the value general in the Department of Public Works to determine the actual price of the property And therefore, from a market economic point of view, this is quite constricting, and it has been a discouraging factor for people to be able to fully exercise their economic rights and their rights to trade and enshrined in the Constitution. So we are willing to review this and to consider it and to look at it from a different perspective. We have to balance out what was originally intended and the current lived experience of the majority of beneficiaries. We are also looking at the shifting of some powers from the HDA to the minister, because there is currently misalignment and a disjuncture, particularly around acquisition of land to be released for projects. It has been very difficult because of the way government is structured. Land, as we know it, as an immovable property, the Giyama Act provides for it to be consolidated under the register with Public Works as a custodian of all state property in terms of immovable assets. And in this regard, the shift in terms of the PFMA is quite tedious from Public Works to another entity in another department. But it is more easier, that shift between the two separate departments. So if it is a shift from Public Works to Human Settlements, it's much more easier. But the current provisions that the land can only be released and be acquired by HDA for Human Settlement Development has created a practical nightmare from an operational point of view. And the policy seeks to address this by making sure that since it is the minister in terms of the law that declares the priority housing development areas, that consequently it follows that the minister should too be the one that releases the land suitable to this priority development areas, and it is also more practical and easier for the minister to acquire such transfer of land from Public Works to Human Settlements, and this now cleans up and streamlines the process and makes it much more easier. Mm-hmm. Public Works will continue, or rather HDA will continue playing a key critical role as a developer of choice for government, but save for the fact that the land will be acquired and released by the minister. We are also looking at the issue of expropriation of land and buildings for human settlement purposes. And in this regard, one needs to point out that the most telling statement in the policy is that our target really is not a wholesale approach. Our target is specifically where such land has been identified as being underutilized and which is also well located for development of human settlements, and that seeks to address some of the key policy trajectory and proposals, including bridging the special divide and land that is most suitable in inner cities and in urban areas at which practically for mixed-use purposes where even the poor can have access to staying closer to economic opportunities. We're also looking in this regard on the area-based precinct infrastructure funding in terms of the policy. In this regard, our key recognition, Chair, has been the idea that we have been declared Human Settlements Department. But if you had looked at our instruments up until now, largely, we have largely been funded as a housing department. And many of our instruments, including the grants that are in place, have been geared in this regard to financing the top structures as well as all of that. And there's been a tweaking of this and there in a piecemeal approach to address issues like bulk, which have been dogging development for a significant period of time. What this policy now seeks to do in this regard is to actually reconfigure in a complete overhaul the funding landscape of the human settlements landscape. And this now speaks to streamlining of budgets and linkages as well as syndication of projects between us and other sector departments that we are dependent on, including roads, including transport, including sports, including health, including education, including water and sanitation, and related sector departments that we are dependent on to have viable human settlements proposals. And in this regard, it then means that in our attempt at following the district development model and our attempt at ensuring syndication and harmonization of our projects, we seek to embed this as a totally new precinct by which all the sector stakeholders can sign up to a precinct, and that funding is then made available to follow a comprehensive precinct-based development model. So in this regard, these are some of the, I've just chosen five of the key issues that I believe the white paper presents, and we are open to discussions. Nothing is cast in stone, and it's not fait accompli, as others would want to argue. We welcome the inputs that are there. Minister has pointed out to some of the key emerging inputs we have noted and which we are taking to heart and into consideration. And we are also noting that some of the challenges and criticisms we have already gotten. For instance, Minister undertook an interview with Lesedi FM just to explain the key tenets of the new white paper. And after she spoke, we listened to the responses by a series of callers that came onto the station to raise their own issues. Some of them are community-based, but some are quite poignant from a policy point of view. And we then are realizing that there are gaps in the policy that we need to also address by the time we are done. And people have raised the challenges pertaining to issues of title deeds, of how do we, the policy, encourage private sector players to play a role in this? How do we support small-scale developers? Our own thinking in terms of the shift from providing only just top structures, but also for people who are just interested in having service sites and who want to build for themselves. And you may have seen some people wait on the RDP list for a significant period, like 10 years. But once they allocated the house, in a space of a year, they demolish it and they build their own house, the one that they want. But you can really realize that it wasn't about the four-roomed house or the RDP house we're building on top. It is actually that they needed the land where they can build for themselves. And that, too, we are noting. We are looking also on international benchmarking, comparing ourselves with countries of a similar nature and with similar challenges. And we are also looking at other gaps, including on the dangerous and hijacked buildings in inner cities. What do we do about that? And also on backyard dwellers and small-scale developers, and what we are supposed to do about that arrangement. Chair, with your indulgence, would you kindly allow me to invite Dr. Mtongo to speak to the process and to speak to what we are remaining with and what is still to be done in this regard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. You can proceed, Dr. Mtongo.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members, Honourable Minister, Asensha, the DG, members of the community, and colleagues, a very good morning to yourself. I think I will be presenting, Honourable Chairperson, just the basis of the document, but the Honourable Minister and the DG have highlighted really some of the wisdom that we have been acquiring since the initiation of the consultation process from our stakeholders, but also to highlight that I think we are still open to different stakeholders in terms of really engagement and input and clarity, because some of the proposals that we receive, we really need to engage on them so that we make sure that we fully understand. So I'll take you through what we have done, what the key components in terms of the contents of the white paper, but also then some of the processes that we are undertaking as part of the consultation process. I'm not going to dwell on this one, which is a table of contents. So the purpose of this presentation, Honourable Chairperson, is just to appraise the Portfolio Committee on the progress that we have made towards the development of the human settlement, a white paper, but also to solicit input in terms of strengthening this document
but also to indicate the gazetting as well as the consultative process which is underway, but also to highlight some of the future milestones. Honourable Chairperson, the next three slides are just focusing in terms of which is the start of the white paper to saying we started by looking at how housing has evolved going forward, but also maybe what we'll need to strengthen going forward is then to look into saying what, besides just the legislative environment, what did it mean in terms of that. We look into the 1994 developments which are critical, which is post-democratic, that gave us the housing policy. And then post that, the white paper was introduced in 1994, which set a framework of the national housing policy. And its aim was to increase the rate and scale of housing delivery. So the focus really was on housing. This then resulted in the promulgation of the Housing Act, which then extended the provision set out in the white paper by outlining the mandate and operational imperatives of the national department and provincial departments of human settlements, municipalities, and other pertinent stakeholders in the housing delivery. But then in 2004, with international trends and aligning to those trends in the sector, was the introduction of the Comprehensive Plan for Development of Integrated Sustainable Human Settlements. The document, which is commonly called the BNG, served as a strategy which aimed to promote integrated society by developing sustainable human settlements, quality housing within a subsidy system for different income houses. And this is then what then gave effect in terms of the department naming in terms of human settlements, because then that was a paradigm shift, but I will also elaborate. But also just to highlight some of the aspects really over the years that have had effect in terms of the products of housing, in terms of norms, and we started with the 30 square meter norms and standards, which then evolved into a 40 square meter a BNG house, but also then emphasis in terms of then compliance with the SANS standards going forward. And these also had then cost implications in terms of where we are going as a house. So it's important then we look into saying what was then becoming our final product and the cost implications. So in terms of the overview, Honourable Chairperson, is that the white paper just seeks to create an enabling environment for the development of integrated and sustainable human settlements. What it does is to set out a vision. It sets out objectives. It sets out the theory of change, and we always elaborate this is a government adopted theory of change, which seeks then to say what we're not looking at the outputs, but what are the outcomes of the work that we do as government? What difference do we make on the ground? It also makes key policy statements, policy positions, roles and responsibilities of stakeholders towards the integrated human settlements, which is then also why it's important that as part of the consultative process, we are engaging with various stakeholders, starting from a non-governmental organization, the three spheres of government, the private sector, as well as the academic institutions. In terms of then, what is the problem statement that has been identified in terms of why then we had to review this white paper? The persistent housing delivery picture, which demonstrates the absence of clear directives of what constitutes human settlements, lack of role clarification, responsibility, and accountability continue to hinder the development of human settlements. And I think when we engage with community organizations, issues around accountability are coming very much sharply. But also the current Housing Act focus is on housing while we have moved in terms of human settlement. So then the lack of policy and legislative basis of what constitutes a human settlement is a gap, and it's then therefore part of the a problem statement. But also to begin to reflect and flag the economic contribution of human settlement development, both at individual level but also at a country level, where at an individual level we're looking at creation of an asset value going forward to the beneficiaries. But also we still have a lack of a spatial transformation where then we need to systematically respond to entrenched spatial patterns of the apartheid regime across the geographical scales that exacerbate social inequality and economic inefficiency. What then is the strategic foundation of this white paper? Of course, the Constitution of the Republic with specific reference to Section 26, the Sustainable Development Goals with specific reference to Goal 11, which makes reference to planning cities and human settlements for all, access to basic services, energy, housing, transportation, and green public spaces, but also in the process need to reduce resource utilization and environmental impact. But also we have the blueprint, the country's blueprint, which is the National Development Plan, with Chapter 8 focusing on sustainable human settlements and improved quality of life. So then the strategic foundation is really to say, once we have brought about all the interventions that we bring through service delivery, but then does the quality of life of our citizens improve? Also in terms of the strategic foundation is this a slide, which is the diagram is borrowed from the NDP, which then says if you are to transform human settlement, you can't just focus on provision of a top structure or a house, but there's so many elements that needs to be considered, the economy and employment, economic infrastructure, environmental sustainability, inclusive rural economy, safer communities, but as well as capable and developmental states. So these are the aspects saying when we also talk of integration, these are the aspects that we need to, the white paper begins to unpack to saying how then do we respond, ensure that from a legislative framework, we are responding in terms of the aspects of integration. Honorable Chairperson, in terms of the policy context of the white paper, is that the sector underwent fundamental policy, legislation, and structural reforms in the past 20 years and made significant functional shifts, including the expansion of the department's mandate from housing to human settlements. But also, in the process, the macro-planning environment demonstrated significant changes, wherein the state revisited the manner in which delivery of targets are developed and assigned assignment of responsibilities. Further to this, in terms of the policy context, is the prevailing notion that the right to access to adequate housing requires the state to build housing for the population and people, and that people without housing can automatically demand a house from the state. So these are some of the areas that we need to clarify. Hence, then the issues around the beneficiaries that the minister was highlighting is an area that we are really engaging on and with the different stakeholders. But also then I think the minister highlighted that we highlight that the right to access to adequate housing does not oblige the government to construct a house for every citizen. And these are the areas that we say beyond just consultation, how then do we build the capacity in terms of knowledge of our legislative frameworks going forward so that we don't create unnecessary expectations. But then it focuses that the right to access to housing covers measures that are needed to prevent homelessness, to prohibit forced evictions, address issues around discrimination, but as well as focus on the most vulnerable and marginalized groups of our society. So such measures then require intervention from government at various levels, which then include spending priorities, legislative and administrative intervention. So, Honourable Chairperson and members, the draft white paper seeks to address the prevailing gaps and inconsistencies in the housing and human settlement sector. It seeks to respond comprehensively to contemporary local and international reforms. Hence, then we're making reference in terms of the Constitution, the NDP, but as well as the SDG. But also to adequately respond to integrated planning strategies, including existing framework, which is the district development model, which serves to amplify the role of the private sector, improve public environment, requisite institutional capacity, and active citizen participation as instruments for sound and effective policy frameworks going forward. What then are the key objectives of the white paper? The first one is integration, wherein the white paper seeks to promote alignment in the development planning while progressively developing governance and administrative capacity through sustainable human settlements delivery approaches, but also then to ensure alignment by addressing the embedded policy and legislative and program design gaps, while regulatory inconsistencies to reflect contemporary reforms, including reconciling it to the international treaties and agreements as well as declarations. The other objective is really to promote innovation and flexibility, wherein then in terms of our legislation, you find that there is level of rigidness. So the white paper then seeks to create a legislative framework to harness innovative, and innovative could be both in terms of technological, but also in terms of societal ideas. Hence, then the citizen participation is central in terms of what the white paper seeks to address, but as well as transformative approaches where then we can embark on through human settlements development. And lastly, then is inclusiveness, wherein then we seek to promote human settlement system that functions as a whole. And that slide which I had shared, Honourable Chair and members, in terms of the various aspects that would inform human settlements that needs to be taken into consideration. What then are the principles that underpin the white paper? I'm not going to go into details, but we're looking into equity, where we're saying a subsidy program should be based on a transparent and objective criterion, affordability, administrative efficiency, which is one of the areas that is really coming out in terms of inefficiencies, so that then we can realize efficient delivery of services, quality assurance, where in terms of compliance with the requisite sector standards, including safety, durability, and livability. And these are issues that really seek to address the issues where then we have an investment in terms of housing products, but then you find that the quality requires an additional investment, which then is not sustainable economically. But also then partnerships and people-centered development, wherein then we develop processes that will enable active citizen participation in need identification. So in terms of human settlements, need identification, the planning processes, and implementation. So those are the issues to say. Then we have to ensure active participation, not only at the end of delivery, but also I think I've highlighted in terms of innovation. And then lastly, the collaboration, coordination, as well as communication to service important protocols going forward. What then are the policy key policy shifts in terms of housing to human settlements? Is that what the white paper seeks to do is the development of an overarching policy framework to respond to macro planning environment, including roles, responsibilities and functions within the different spheres of government. And this I will elaborate as in terms of the consultative process, where then we are not only just consulting in terms of the inputs, but also we are looking at legislative enablers with other sector departments, but also then to recalibrate the grant funding frameworks. I think the DG was highlighting some of this, so that we can make sure that we optimize performance of existing grant instruments in order to respond to human settlements, as well as to then inform the amendment of the Housing Act and to provide rationale for the Human Settlements Development Act. Honourable Chairperson, I will then take you through some of the key policy proposals. These are not exhaustive, but I think some of them the DG has already highlighted. Among these is then that the priority to be given to vulnerable groups, the elderly, child-headed families, and people with disabilities. And we are getting a lot of inputs around this in terms of saying the qualification criteria needs to be looked into and, as part of the white paper. A collaborative review of current land administration to embrace the empowerment of women to access land and land titles. Exploration of quicker, simplified, and less costly processes of registration and transfer of land and property to poor households, but also to review and adjust the preemptive rights clause to ensure upward mobility and curb informal transaction of house, of subsidized housing. And this is also an area of interest in terms of the stakeholder engagement. Engaging beneficiaries in decision-making processes to foster a sense of ownership and empowerment among residents, thereby contributing to sustainable outcomes. This one is important, Chairperson, because when we talk integrated, sustainable human settlement, we need to break those down and understand when we say sustainability, it's not only talking in terms of climate change, but we're saying can communities be able to sustain themselves socially as well as economically in their settlements. With regard to informal settlements upgrading, advocacy will be towards the prioritization of participatory planning as well as implementation in terms of what aspects need to be taken into consideration. And then that in terms of upgrading informal settlements, the focus will be on in-situ upgrading, which then focuses on incremental upgrading, and relocation of communities will be the last resort consideration, because this considered that people would be located in a particular informal settlement for certain purposes, whether it's access to education, but also in terms of access to economic opportunities. So relocating them is creating an inconvenience, hence then it is considered to be the last resort. An area of interest as well is the backyard housing, which the white paper does focus on, but also then to saying we need to look into saying how do we firm up necessary regulatory measures amenable to building standards, which is an important aspect, the formalization and provision of the required internal bulk infrastructure, so that we don't promote backyard housing that is then going to compromise the quality of infrastructure that is serving the communities. When it comes to social housing market, the principles anchor affordability, accessibility, safety, and contribution to socioeconomic growth while effectively addressing demand and contributing to spatial restructuring. Furthermore, the proposal is that there needs to be a consideration in terms of cost-effective construction methods. There's options in terms of building materials. We have innovative building technologies, but also to begin to tap into technological advancement, where which is an initiative that the minister is driving now in terms of how do we digitize the housing needs register, so that also citizens can be in control in terms of managing how they are responded to, but also to ensure that we have transparent processes going forward. So that is what we believe that digital platforms would be able to assist us going forward. But to ensure that human settlement projects are contained within the urban edge of development nodes and strategic locations along the development corridors in order to curb urban sprawl. And lastly then, to saying Chairperson, emphasis is being placed on settlement design principles that produce safe, livable, and inclusive spaces that result in an improved quality of life for all citizens. Like I indicated, this is not exhaustive in terms of the policy proposals, so we've selected some that we so that we can highlight. This slide is just highlighting, saying as a consultations in terms of drafting the white paper, we had to engage with some stakeholders so that we could get to a point where we have a draft, which then we are presenting to the committee this morning. And in terms of the progress to date, Honourable Chair, the Cabinet approved for public comment on the 29th of November, and then on the 18th of December it was gazetted through government printers. And then in January, the initial date was the end of January, and then the minister then approved the extension in terms of receiving public inputs, and then that was gazetted on the 26th of January. And this is just highlighting in terms of where it's available, the departmental website, the urban knowledge exchange. So we have been collaborating with various stakeholders also to make sure that there's access in terms of the document. Some of the stakeholders have briefly highlighted in terms of summarizing their perspectives and shared with the different stakeholders, South Africa, Twitter, Facebook, as well as WhatsApp. As the Minister indicated, Honourable Chair, we are doing roadshows with the provinces and the metros. And I must indicate that also there's engagements that are driven by SALGA, as well as COCTA, but also we do receive individual requests from organizations so that we can engage. I think yesterday we even had a group of two, but we did the full presentation in terms of that. But further to that, I think the Minister highlighted also in terms of strategic engagements, especially when it comes to ensuring that we do have we achieve integration going forward as proposed in the white paper, to engage with beyond the written submissions, but really to engage with particular stakeholders, SALGA, the built environment professions. We have engaged with them, but also to look into saying what is then the role of professionals going forward in order for us to realize integrated and sustainable human settlements. National Treasury have already provided inputs, but also we are engaging so that then we can look into saying, especially when it comes to funding modules, we are specific in terms of how we deal with that. We have on an ongoing basis engaging civil society and NGOs. Minister indicated that on Monday she was indicating there's a platform also that is being created by the South African Cities Network, I think which will be in the upcoming week. And then all the provincial Department of Human Settlements provinces are hosting with the national department in terms of identifying key stakeholders and make sure that sometimes we have more than one in each province depending on the demand. So we have allocated ourselves to make sure that we are available for any specific requests. But also to saying going forward, as part of the consolidation, we have through the Office of the DG requested other the identified sector stakeholders that we think are important, so that then we have a technical working group that will consider the input that will be received, so that then we can begin also to engage in terms of what are the legislative enablers from their side as we consider input and we finalize the document. This is just highlighting in terms of the schedule of the upcoming which are run by the provinces, but some are virtual, some are hybrid, and they are still ongoing. So in terms of preliminary written inputs, we have various individuals that have submitted: COGTA, Treasury, City Support Program within Treasury, Social Development, Department of Women, Youth and People with Disabilities, Gauteng Province, we've already done, Northwest, KZN. So this is just not exhaustive in terms of but where written inputs have been received. So in terms of then the future milestone, Honourable Chairperson, it will be then the consolidation of inputs and revision of the white paper, and then the revised white paper will undergo required approvals, and therefore, and thereafter will be then taken through the cabinet approval processes, which was highlighted by the minister. Chairperson, then the recommendation is that the committee notes the progress that we have made, the gazetting and the consultative process that is underway, but also then the future milestones. And that will be the end of my presentation. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, CG and team. Now allow members to engage on the presentation. You're welcome to engage with the presentation, honorable members. Honorable Makasene, honorable Mpiti, honorable Malo, and honorable Harold, and then followed by honorable Wing. Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Also, let me welcome the draft presentation white paper, and also acknowledge, note the introduction, especially by the minister, where she gave us the challenges and things that they have, but Makopana Letona, as they do their consultation. But I felt as if they are not doing enough to engage the ordinary citizen, although they just started to engage the traditional leaders because and the councillors. If it depends to a member or a councillor to drive submission to request the department to come and present, it must be mandatory. Maybe they must have a program where they force the citizens so that in at least in every province they must consult with the citizen so that they get the gist of the problem. And also I welcome the issue that they have raised of rent to own for the people, because sometimes you were not working, now you are financially sustainable, you want to buy the property, it will be easy the burden to the department that every time, so that with the ownership of the people, they must own the land and the houses. And I also welcome the issue that we raised last year before we close, the issue of the bank. But I think they must also have the banks where they consult with the banks, because they are not operating the same. You found the second bank is working in a different, there's an agreement with the department. Other bank is not even willing to interact with the department. So they must just, there's a body of the banks. Let them call all the banks, because really what they are doing to our people is a scam. Even if you engage them on your challenges, they just continue to reprocess, especially if they are aware we are almost done to pay your properties. They must enforce that one also, to consult with the bank so that we have enough. But my issues on issue of emergency housing of the 72 hours, especially for those people if you are not a South African. That process is not monitored. I think the accountability and the, especially on the side of the department, they are not doing enough. Because sometimes they leave people to stay in those houses more than 72 2 hours. After a certain 3 months, they will come and do things, and they fought with those people, because those people also, they have their right, they are protected by the Constitution. If they say it's 72 hours, they must stick to 72 hours so that they don't have a problem to have to fight and to look for another accommodation for other people. But the issue, again, DG, on the emergency houses, you must go and check Thukela municipality, where we raised the issue of the houses that were there. Then there were people who were affected by the floods. The only thing that they will receive, those people now on this flood, the latest flood, is a plastic bag to cover their houses. Is what 9. Umbulawayo, the project is called Umbulawayo. It's only the plastic bag, but we know there's monies that were issued by the department to the provinces so that they can deal with the issues of emergency. I don't know how to do it so that they can add in your white paper to protect the citizen that to be exposed in that environment. All those people that are there is our South African people. Then another issue, the issue of the beneficiary. I'm happy it's been advocated in the white paper policy, because a lot of those houses in that project, the beneficiaries are wrong. Umandi Sawuhlala kwaMhlongo, they say they are going to swap. I just want to check, it's going to be possible if ngumZulu, omnye ngumXhosa, kunye ndinesiko lam, sendenze izinyanya zasekhaya in this house. Now when the house is done, you say I must go ndiyohlala kwaMhlongo. It's not going to be possible. So at least the issue of the beneficiaries, if they can it must be well coordinated, because there's a mess in that project of that houses. But generally, I don't have a problem, and I'm here with the principals. If there are 7 principals, at least they will assist them to move forward.
Thank you very much, Chair. I'd also like to welcome the presentation as well. I think the idea to move from looking at housing from a human settlement perspective is a very progressive one. Just a number of things on my side. I also welcome the Minister's input before her leave. I think, Chair, it's not a nice way to start off the discussion of the white paper when the Minister spoke about the fact that the Constitution says that people have a right to shelter, but doesn't mean it must be done by government. I think that statement is incredibly wrong. And I think when we look...
Sorry,
you missed that. Oh, okay. I'm saying the statement made by the Minister that the Constitution provides a right for shelter for people, but that does not mean it must be done by government, is an incredibly wrong statement. And, you know, when we look at the Constitution, it says that government, by all its power, must ensure progressively that it provides shelter for citizens, particularly those that are indigent. So I just wanted to make that note. She is not here, but I just wanted to say that that is not a statement that I think allows for this particular white paper to be received in a manner that the spirit in which it's been drafted to be. But to move on from that point, Chair, just a number of issues that I wanted to maybe get clarity on. I'm interested in the white paper, page 48, speaks around the issue of relocation being the last resort. And I just wanted to just get some clarity around that issue. I mean, when you read in page 48, it speaks about the importance of upgrading informal settlements, which I accept. But I feel that the document is very weak on instances of unlawful occupation of land. There's only 2 lines or 2 sentences in, I think it's on page 48 and page 50, where it says that in instances where unlawful occupation of land is imminent or in process, the authorities must proactively take all necessary legal measures to protect both private and public property. I think it needs to be stronger than that, because we have seen how illegal occupation across the country has indeed affected property rights. And I think we need to be able to speak more thoroughly to that, because when we've raised those issues, Jay, in this committee, we've been told that there needs to be a collaboration between the police and human settlements, but we've never really seen that collaboration taking place. And so if the document is calling for that, I think there needs to be some form of way to address that particular point, because in the same breath, it says that relocation must be the lost process. But if it's the lost process in illegal land, then, you know, what is that communicating? So I think those statements are a bit contradictory to each other, in my view. So maybe just to have some proper clarification around that particular issue. And then the issue around backyard housing, or backyard dwellers, I think it's an important one, because it's a challenge. One, to try to regulate that particular aspect, when for many, I think, South Africans, to have umkuku, to have a room outside, is a way in which one makes money and sustains their family in that particular household. So just to understand, what type of regulation would that encompass? Because I know one of the points that were made was around the issue of the type of materials that are used in building that backyard. And many of these houses that are, you know, are built at the back, many of them are not actually concrete. Some of them, lizenke, put together, you know what I mean? And that still generates some form of income for that particular household. So does that mean that if you have umkuku that's made with izenge, you'll be, you know, in contradiction of whatever this regulation may be? I think we need to consider that aspect as well. What type of regulation should we be putting on those particular issues? Because not everybody is going to be able to afford proper materials to build, you know, umkuku that is in regulation of that. It must be concrete, it must be this, it must be that. So we need to just understand that. But also on this point, I mean, we've seen in Johannesburg, in Denver, that the city of Johannesburg has built corrugated housing, temporary housing. You know, so even government is actually not using the materials that they should be using to build temporary housing in the case of Denver. So I think we need to really just have some way of maybe that consultation would be very important for many communities, particularly because it is a source of income in many households. And then I just wanted to touch on the point of the HDA and the shifting of powers to the minister. I'm always against shifting of powers to politicians. I think it's very problematic when politicians have some form of power. So just to understand, because when the way I understood that point, it was around the minister being able to identify land that is underutilized. So I really don't agree with this one. I don't believe that the minister should have that power. I think the power should remain with HDA. I think it really needs to be understood why the minister's office, or why the minister in particular, because we know that us as politicians, we have an ability to do things wrong. That's just the reality of it. And so I just want to understand, what does it mean to shift those powers to the minister? What is the benefit of that happening? What is the capacity in the minister's office to be able to do, to me, what seems very technical ability to identify land, to you know, a number of things that have to go with that particular process? Why does it need to be shifted to the minister's authority? What are the challenges that have led to the HDA perhaps not fulfilling that particular ambit of work that now needs those powers to shift to the minister? It's something that would really need to be expanded upon. I think the issue of the beneficiaries is a very welcomed point. I do think, you know, we have to look at the levels of what is the face of poverty now, and what is the face of people who are struggling with housing now. So I welcome that part of investigation, because indeed, child-headed homes, women in this country, are the face of poverty, and we need to be able to understand and diversify at least at that point. So I very much welcome that point, and I think even the inputs that I received from the public participation will actually help to give more life to this particular point as well. And then I think the last point is just a point of clarity on, I think there were 5 points, I'm not sure what page it was, but around where there is no land that is available, there will be a look at the inner city commercial to residential conversions, upgrading of RDP, or discount benefit schemes. So just clarity on the second point, the upgrading of RDP, etc. I think my colleague had already spoken around that, of selling of RDP houses. I was watching Moja Love the other day, and this lady was renting an RDP house from another lady who had another house, and she was, you know, speaking about that. But I think that is something that is happening in our communities. And we need to, not necessarily to regulate it, but there needs to be something that really needs to happen around how people who already have houses are getting more houses, while people who don't have houses continue to not have houses. It's not a fair process where people have received an RDP house and now have a house again. I do think something needs to be said there in the policy around that particular issue. And then just an explanation on what upgrading of the RDP would mean, and discount benefit scheme housing as well. There was also a mention on community schemes. I did read it somewhere. Just to touch on that, what reference was made in regards to community schemes, gated communities, I think it was put in the document. I think that's something that we do need to understand. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm sure I'm audible, right? Awesome. Thank you very much, and good morning to the colleagues. Maybe just a few things from my side. I am glad and welcome the presentation. The intent of the white paper is very welcome. And of course, there is, you know, a background around why we are doing this, or why the department is doing this, precisely based on some of the challenges that the housing, or the Department of Human Settlements, let me use the correct lingo, is actually basing these on the challenges that the department experiences. And so it is very welcome. I think perhaps maybe just a few things that I'm curious to see that aren't coming quite prominently across to me, that I regard also as challenges, and perhaps maybe it will come up in terms of, you know, the inputs that are being given, and I certainly will also offer or submit some inputs. But maybe in relation to, you know, the rental approach, you know, it does, the white paper does make reference to that, in terms of building houses, where people, you know, people don't settle in cities forever or endlessly. They want to rent, and, you know, while they want to buy before they settle in the city, or they come in the city for a period of time and they move out. And I think we've heard from provinces on a number of occasions around the challenge of managing rental stock in various provinces. So I thought perhaps we could maybe talk a little bit more around the vision or the approach or what the policy stance would be precisely just to manage rental stock, especially because we've heard from provinces such as the Northern Cape, if my memory serves me well, where they're struggling to collect rent, for instance, or struggling to get people who are working out of those units in order for other people that need housing to move in, which then leads me to the next point, Chairperson, around the challenges, though. Around informal settlements. Obviously, the law doesn't allow government to demolish or take away anybody's house or structure, and that includes informal housing, you know, structures. And we've discussed on a number of occasions the challenge around, you know, you build, there's an informal settlement, we put it out and we build a new settlement for them, there's housing units elsewhere. But the reality is that, you know, you don't demolish those structures. And what happens is people re-rent or resell those shacks, and then, you know, you continuously have that area, whether it's inhabitable, in some instances, those structures aren't, and they on flood lines and all of it, and we see it a lot in Gauteng as well. And every year we sit with the same issues around disaster management, because, you know, you move those people now and new people will either rent or sell, or the children and the cousin from somewhere else comes in to live there. So I wanted to maybe perhaps understand if there is a vision around that. Of course there are ideas around working around such challenges, but I wanted to see if we have something that we are looking at in terms of dealing with that. And I do think the rent to buy option could easily be lucrative. It sounds great. I think if I was straight out of varsity and this was an option, I would probably think and consider it, because it would work for me. But I'm not sure whether or not in the vision of what Human Settlements wants to do or achieve, it would be very beneficial to do, because the idea that we've discussed here, and I think the Minister has also mentioned it on one of our addresses to us, is that, you know, the department wants to retain these structures, even when you want to rent them and people move out, so that you can actually accommodate other people on this huge housing backlog that we have to occupy those houses, and hence we don't allow people to sell government houses, so to speak. It becomes illegal because we want to be able to help less fortunate people as other people become fortunate or become able to, you know, sustain themselves or to afford housing. So maybe just an understanding around where, how that perhaps links to the vision of the department, if that were to be in place, and how that will gel with what the vision is. I mean, for me as a citizen, it would probably be great, but from a department perspective and looking at the housing needs and backlog, I'm just trying to understand and some of the challenges around land and all of it. And then just maybe one of the other things I think that is important that should be discussed or covered in the white paper, also to address some of the challenges that are experienced in the department, obviously in relation to budget and the availability of funds to actually build houses, over and above land, is also alternative building technologies. I don't know to what extent we are driving that, because we talk about the cost of building materials being so expensive in the document, and we've discussed how it is a challenge that construction companies every year increase, you know, they delay the project so that they can keep increasing I think there's a term for it, the VAT, but they keep every year they keep increasing, and so the delay project. And to combat some of those challenges, I'm wondering to what extent we are considering alternative building materials. I know we have spoken about it, or technologies rather, including innovative building material like hemp concrete and all of it that is available out there. You know, research, there's been a lot of research around addressing some of these challenges that we're facing. And perhaps just put it out there, and, you know, if it hasn't been thought out, but I do know that in terms of, you know, budgetary constraints and, you know, lessening the budgetary burdens that we experience, I think that would be one of, you know, two of options that I think the department should really be pushing and trying to have a policy stance around managing those particular challenges. And I think perhaps just lastly also maybe just to add in terms of the beneficiary list, I think that is an important point to ventilate with communities and various stakeholders, because indeed, you know, is an elderly person take, you know, precedence over a young person, over a person with living with a disability, or over child-headed families? But I do think that is something that we have discussed on a number of occasions, because if I'm elderly, Dr. Mkhize is 22, and the next person is, you know, a child. Who are you going to give a... Where's the first available house going to go to? You know, is it going to a 22-year-old? Or, you know... So I do definitely welcome some of the, you know, points that the minister is
identifying as issues to be addressed around the illegal immigrants as well, and in relation to human rights. I think that's one of the things that I'm very passionate about, and I think the department should really consider something like that, because human life is important over whatever citizenship you hold, and I do believe that that would be something that I would want to see making it through onto the white paper, where we do accommodate even illegal immigrants when it comes to, and maybe I am being a bit controversial, but when it comes to human life, I think we ought to try to protect at whatever cost. And even if it is for a certain period where for 72 hours you're allowing these people to have some shelter when, while they, you know, find alternatives for themselves. So I think, Chairperson, I'll stop there and allow other members to give input. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. If I may just in general say that
raise your hand. I didn't know you'll come after Mr. Dick.
Yeah, that's fine. I just want you to notice. You know, this is what happens if you're 22 years.
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. I think just in general comments in to start with, I think there is a fundamental need for an overhaul of the housing program, and I've been calling for that for a long time. So I think that there is a need for a new approach to housing, because the current approach is not working. But when I read the white paper, it feels to me that what the department is trying to achieve is a reduction in the rights of South Africans to adequate housing. And it's and that's a disappointing overhaul of the housing program, when I think we should be enhancing access to adequate housing rather than trying to find ways to reduce the right to housing. And it comes through in a number of parts of the white paper. If I may just quickly just talk about the consultation before I get into some of my concerns around the white paper. And this morning, as I said earlier to the chairperson, I collected the memorandum that the chairperson was asked to collect, and the concerns there are largely around consultation. If you read in the white paper, the history of the Housing Act and the housing program included extensive consultation, the Housing Forum and the Botchabella Accord, and so the history of developing our housing program was a culmination of extensive consultation. And a complete overhaul of the housing program, I don't think, should be absent that level of consultation. So I think there's merit in the complaint that the consultation process has been removed from the people of South Africa, gazetted in December, the week before Christmas, and not adequately published to the extent where people could engage with it. If I may just talk about some of the particular concerns I have, I think the idea that we can redefine what adequate housing is to include, to be understood, as it says on page 5 of the white paper, that it doesn't necessarily mean housing, but could also just mean land, access to land. And I think that even though it's true that maybe some communities and some beneficiaries would accept land as a housing opportunity, I don't think we can define adequate housing by reducing what the constitutional courts have already defined as adequate housing. And the idea that land constitutes adequate housing, I think, won't meet constitutional muster, and certainly is, I would imagine, not what South Africans are expecting from the developmental state that we profess to be. Sorry, I've made lots of notes in these documents. I'm going to just go down. I think that if you look in the context and background as to how the white paper came about, and I'm now on page 8 of the document, there's a reference to the current approach being a welfarist approach policy. And I think that that's an insulting way to frame this, the approach to housing. I mean, it's a human right entrenched in our constitution in terms of Section 26. So we can't talk about it being welfare. It is a right to adequate housing as enshrined in the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And to refer to the current policy as welfarist, I think, is part of what I'm regarding or reading through in this document as a reduction in the rights of South African's housing rights. The shift to the sustainable human settlements, I think, is an important shift, and it's long been spoken about, and it has long been tinkered with. And here we come again to tinker with it. If we go back a decade ago, I think, we introduced what was called the Built Environment Performance Plan, which certainly the metros had to implement in order to get grant funding. And they had to demonstrate that the funding was accumulating in an area to create sustainable settlements and sustainable developments. So the idea that you can't just build housing without schooling and other amenities was already part of the thinking that came from Treasury and COGTA about 10 years ago, when before metros could get their grant funding, they had to produce a built environment performance plan. So sustainable human settlements was certainly part of that, and I wonder why that process has been abandoned or why it wasn't successful and why introducing it in a new Human Settlements Act would change that. Just bear with me, Chair. There's a part where it says that there's a misalignment between what national government, provincial governments and municipalities regard as a priority in terms of the integration. And I would suggest that a way of dealing with that instead of allocating more functions to municipalities, which I support, is to use the conditional grant funding to ensure that there is alignment with the national priorities of integrating human settlements within cities and towns. And grant funding should not be paid if it's not used for that purpose. So I think the earmarking or the conditionality attached to grant funding can address that challenge. I think I've made the point about a reduction in what we are trying to achieve. I think if I can just go to the beneficiaries or the oh, I actually wanted to make this point because in your list of litigation where you set out what case law is established, I think this supports the argument that saying that land is an adequate housing reaches the standard of adequate housing. One of the cases you cite is the Port Elizabeth municipality versus various occupiers. And there you say that the Constitutional Court said that a home is more than just a shelter from the elements. So a piece of land won't even meet the definition of a shelter. So I think that to say that adequate housing can include just a piece of land will not meet the definition of adequate housing in terms of the Constitution. I think one of the big problems, and maybe what I was hoping to see in the overhaul of the housing policy, is that the policy or the implementation of a new housing program be more demand-driven. So there's a reference here to 2.3 million people registered on the housing register. But I wonder if we know, and I know from when my time in the city of Cape Town, we didn't know, so I don't know if the National Housing Department knows or Human Settlement Department knows, what those beneficiaries qualify for in terms of the current human settlements program. So if we can start to understand who is on the housing register and what they qualify for, then we know that what we need to be building. But just to build houses on the periphery and hope and then find the beneficiaries to fill those houses doesn't make sense. I think we really need to start with who's on the register, do they qualify in terms of the housing program, and what do they qualify for, so we know what we need to be building in terms of any housing program, whether it's the current one or the program that we implement. In terms of the economic factors that seem to be informing a shift, the economic factors seem to be the decline in our economic growth and therefore the fiscal constraints. Now, I think that we should be focusing, our state should be focusing on addressing the economic growth crisis rather than saying we have a reduction in our GDP and therefore we have to cut housing programs. The housing program should be addressing the needs of South Africans for adequate housing, which is their right, and we should be making sure that we're working on the economic growth trajectory so that the state can actually fund the housing program, rather than cutting the housing program, and then the economy maybe grows in the future, and we all hope it does, and we've got this reduced housing program that was responding to a crisis that we can probably address through other measures. Just finally on informal settlements, I think that the approach to informal settlements is problematic because it starts from the premise, and there seems to be an excessive, to me, an excessive focus on unlawful, as you call it, unlawful occupations. Now, in the document acknowledges the high rate of urbanization. A human being has to be somewhere at all times. It's just by nature of being a human being, you have to be somewhere. You have to sleep somewhere, you have to live somewhere, and if you arrive as part of an urbanization wave from a rural area into a more urban area seeking opportunities, and there's nowhere for you to be, I don't see how your occupation can be unlawful, because where are you supposed to be? So the idea that we are going to clamp down on unlawful occupations because it's people are doing this, occupying land unlawfully because they want to jump the queue, is part of my response that this is a reduction in human rights and a reduction in housing rights, and it makes wildly inappropriate assumptions around the people who are urbanizing and where they're urbanizing, rather than focusing on the fact that South Africa is a rapidly urbanizing country, and therefore our municipalities, our provinces, and the National Department of Human Settlements should be proactively planning for that urbanization so that we're not saying that people are unlawfully occupying land when they have nowhere else to live. And there was just one other comment that I wanted to make in the informal settlement space, and that is the introduction of, I think you refer to illegal immigrants as part of the informal settlement problem. And to me, I'm wondering whether that isn't an exaggeration, that the problem is not illegal immigrants to the extent that it needs to be in a white paper, that the proportion of illegal immigrants occupying informal settlements probably doesn't warrant being included in a white paper, and the problems in informal settlements are not as a result of illegal immigration, but rather the lack of planning for urbanization. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, this is massive. This is at the center of our economic development property. So just the first two points that I would want to raise is that probably as a committee, we need to engage with our legal team. Even if the department is not there alone, just to stretch on the challenges that we have met as we do oversight and to seek advice, legal advice. That would be a proposal, Chair. But also to engage, I'm not sure in terms of consultation, DG, whether you are also talking to law enforcement agencies, because they're important in this. Police will come in and harass people. When they go to court, they win the case. So it's a wastage of resources sometimes. So our input should be of reference to legislation framework or regulations or codes, the housing code the DG spoke about. Because the housing code will also talk about the 3,500. This 3,500 has been there since inception. Now the question is that should we increase? Is it going to create problems? But I think it was offsetted by the FLISP, which is changed to new house. Was it? Yeah, first home finance, yes. I think it's offsetted by that as you, but we know that if you earn 5,000 between 3,005 and 7, you can't get a bond, which is another disadvantage. So that's another issue that needs to be engaged as well. There's an issue of minors and majors. When a minor owns a house, obviously this minor doesn't have authority. When I say minor, I mean about a person that is disabled who will be a minor until death. But you'll find that this person has received an RDP house. You know, what are the relationships with the next of kin that is going to take over the house? Should we continue to do that, or the minor should be automatically be benefiting within the family? But what if there's none, you know, there's no close relationship? You know, those are the challenges we come across, Chairperson. There are people, whether it's invasion member or not, but people will just occupy land, build beautiful houses, whereas that land is, they are illegal in the land. In many meetings, we met Mangaung, we met Free State, but if you go to Tsavel, and I cry every time because I drive there and I pass seeing the sheikhs, didn't kill the whole economic node between the shopping complex, the two shopping complexes, how can Tsavelo leave the other one that is inside, that main street. They've occupied. Even go Batukada, Dalante, Mankile, that place. And municipality is doing nothing. So I'm just off on that one because of interest. There's what we called FedUp, an organization called FedUp. This organization builds 50 square meter house. They are adding a certain amount to your 40 square meter. These are stakeholders that I think we should take them serious on a high note, because they are building for people who qualified in terms of the RDP requirements. But because they belong to this organization, they build themselves and they build 50 square meter house. Can't we benefit from such institution? I think it should be one of the stakeholders that you take. And then the issue of the list, we have been saying, Chairperson, I think you have been saying this many times, that let's make these lists of waiting for RDP transparent. They may be transparent now because if you go to HSS, you are able to seek number 10,000 out of 20,000. Yes! Am I going to get a house? Yesterday I was consulting with someone. It's 8,000 out of 15. So, but at least the person knows that she or he is in the system. So can we try to make this... there's an issue of hostels, Chair. What is the future of hostel? Kofoslora's. That's where we are. With arms in the hostel. So, really, if anything can happen coming from the hostel, or it's happening even now, coming from the hostels, but now take that as a dereliction of duty by the state. And that state has mandated human settlement to act on those areas. And the human settlement is not acting. Because the issue is not about breaking away the hostel, but is making it humanely livable, where you could just make some streets that are coming from the township or from town, going through this former hostel now. It's integrated into the community. But now it's surrounded. Hey, you get inside there. Pele baba mbadi booth now, get it tavernic, all sorts of business. Illegally so. So can you really take that serious? The selling of house in 8 years, this one is also a dereliction of duty. I heard what the minister said. Because this thing, you can make an announcement as human settlement to say, we are going to do a sample of people that have sold these houses before that time. And people will know there's a law. They will act within a law. There was also a discussion about biometrics to say maybe from time to time, Chair, the human settlement will do a sample again to say, let's just do into biometrics. And check who's staying in this house so that we are able to correct the ownership. Malova Mova is a poor old lady who Albertine. And then Bamlata Volimpope assign a happy letter. And then these people are taking over the house. They are buying it, in essence. So there are all those elements within the department that you need to uproot. There's this thing here, back out, which was done, I know, of Kosibuke. What they did, Chair, Bahailand today, two RDPs in 1 year. One is for rental, for this person so that he can be able to pay for municipality services or to pay for whatever. Two houses in. And then how of it we have? Mutu ha rent is. When I lent to the two already. It's my house. It's my yard. I think that one in my view, remember, I read to say this thing must, in my view, it must just stop. It should not continue. It's a waste. These backyard houses in the same yard, where there were government, no, not your address, issue of backyard rooms, where people are staying, renting the backyard, and they don't have RDP. This one is two RDPs built in 1 yard. For me alone, I'm expect. Yes, it's go Gauteng. I get to the pregnant lady. It's a waste of resources of the state, to be honest. Mutual of 8 room, 1 car. No, it's there in the policies, Chair. How dang it, they did it. The room, no, I know. So much is legal. Mamsong, agree, go how dang, you know this thing is. Okay, sorry, Chair. Yeah. No, these are things that you come across, Chair. The other thing that we need to do, we have made a study, while I was still in Gauteng, I think I'll share with you, of family houses, which are creating problems, especially the old four rooms. But I won't want to deal with them a lot. When I learned about separation in the families or divorce, I think you, I don't know, someone said it. Chair, you know, in our okay, there are two that I just need to make the last one, please. Yeah, let me not elaborate too much. Oh, on this one, Kievang Nalim Sariagarea Arwa, we stay separate. And then it's almost a divorce. You know, in an African way, divorce is another thing. You stay there, I stay, or I remain in the house. Akitaka, when I die, Nataka means that you are die. When you die, you come back. When I, let's say someone was staying away, I get the one that is left in the house. When the one that is staying in the house dies, this other one comes and says, "This is my house." You know, she or he was away for 20 years. We need to deal with such things to assist our community. The last Hey, Dingat, I'll write them down because they are quite many. Okay. The other one that you need to look at, when I go to rural areas, we build graves in the yard. And now, why is it to RDP? I mean, we are more violent society. You move now from that house, you sell it. You sell the graves of your ancestors. Nini, you want to visit, you disturb my privacy. You know, those are things. I know I'm making some far-fetched thinkings, but they are real. Now I'm from rural. These things are real. I buy your graves, and then I can stop you not to come to visit your graves. Thank you, Chair. I'll know these others.
Thank you, Chapel. Is there a time limit so I can know? Yes, how many minutes? Okay. No. No, I think that's better. It's better than this one who's trying to suppress me. No, thanks, colleagues. Let's welcome this discussion and the presentation. I think the white paper really, we should be all looking back and saying, over the 30 years, what have we learned, and let's try and pick up the lessons from that and try and see how we can improve on the paper. So maybe let me start with what, as I walked in, Honorable Mpiti was talking about ministerial powers. I didn't hear, firstly, let me say, I think we must be a bit careful. We mustn't deal with the issue of ministerial powers as though actually we don't need ministers as a portfolio. So I think we need to just, if it's specific, we say that one is too much, then you understand. But there has to be a role for the ministerial intervention. There has to be a reason why you have a minister. There has to be a way of balancing out technical issues and then ultimately give certain degree of authority over technical processes and administrative processes and guide based on the requirements of our electorate or the community inside. So I think we just need to be a bit careful. And secondly, the issue of human rights, I think it's clear. When it was said that housing is human right, it was clear. But there's also this language of progressive realization of the rights. Now, that basically means you have to look into the resources available and then take into account what people need to be covered for and then provide what is available. That's why the human settlement has actually been evolving. The first few houses were very small, and then later they started increasing in size and so on. We started changing the approach and so on. That's a progressive realization, so we mustn't lose that. At the end, the government has to provide the housing, but where it's not possible, it's a policy that must encourage people to have access to decent housing, and if not possible, must create an environment or must create opportunities. So all of that together. And this is taking into account the issue of backlogs. Now, many years back, I worked in a province, and we did a calculation that if we were to provide housing at the current rate of delivery of the housing, the number of people who were needing homes in 1994, the last one, if there's no increase in demand,
the last one would get their housing in 2035. And that was basically on the basis of the available resources and the speed of delivery. So we have to take into account the issue of the resources that are available. And the fact that it's a moving target, people keep increasing in numbers. People who are not there in 1994 are here today. They are now in second generation. The second generation is looking for their own houses. So the one thing that I think we do need to encourage is this approach of community housing program. Now, this community housing programs, it does encourage NGOs, it encourages cooperatives, and also it helps the communities to be able to build more affordable houses using, economies of scale. And this we have seen happening. In one of the experiences I've been through, we actually had the whole community involved in almost construction of 25,000 houses. And this becomes, an important empowering approach, and the Human Settlement Department should not really be only encouraging private sector intervention and outside community. So that I think it's an area that does need to be emphasized upon. The issue of elimination of shacks, I think we're a bit more liberal. We should actually be more aggressive about the elimination of shacks. But we need to understand the dynamics involved. There are shack lots, and on that basis, actually, we'll never get rid of the shacks completely. And the shacks are not, nobody just walks into a place and builds a shack. Somebody presides over the allocation of the shacks, and that is where the department needs to be working with municipalities to deal with that aspect. And you can't also get rid of foreigners. The issue of foreigners in shacks is real. I've been in situations where we actually had enough houses to cater for the people in the shacks, and people didn't go and occupy the shacks because the shack laws were the committees in charge of relocation, and they would not let you go to get your new house until you have actually found someone to replace you in the shack. And so after the shacks, it was double the population. And so the issue for us is that people do want to locate themselves where there's economic activity. So you can say whatever you want to say. Most of the disasters, particularly I've seen in Durban, the people had 50,000 houses built 30 kilometers away. They were not prepared to move, so instead they started fighting. Why do you want to move away from here? And those who were in charge were actually threatening those who wanted to relocate. And so these are the issues that you cannot deal with either as national or provincial government. You need the municipality as well to be involved, and so you need everyone to be involved there. The area where I think that the human settlement is moving very slowly on, and I think there this way we should be aggressive. And if we were to get the same sense of the members who are saying this is a human right and so on, similarly, the issue of integration is important. So I would be saying that we should be asking that we as a committee want to demand that for every city, the municipalities, the provincial and national development must give us the amount of land and human and property that's been expropriated in the center of town. They must give us the numbers, and every month, every year we must monitor that, because this is where integration is not taking place. If you go to most of the towns, And you will either find African people in the shacks, and a few who are in the urban centers are those who are professionals and business who have got. The rest of the others are informal settlements, and then of course you'll find that some of the people would be foreign migrants. But we don't have an aggressive program here in line with the IUDF. And this is what I think this committee should demand of the minister, to say how much land are you expropriating in town. A lot of them are dilapidated. If you look at Gauteng, two of the buildings have actually been burnt down. Now, who's owning those buildings? Some of them are government, others are run by NGOs. Why shouldn't we have actually a proper process here? And you can do that with a combination of private and public sector involvement in those situations. I think we need to be very strongly aggressive for that. And your paper must actually lift those up, because it's something that is missing. It's actually making inequality to be entrenched, and yet we are actually having all this peri-urban sprawling when we should have actually be moving people into the center of town on that basis. Yes, people who are poor do need to stay in town. that's where they get their jobs, that's where they'll be able to get opportunities. So I think you need to be very strong on that. But at the same time, the area of rural housing is another area. Apart from community housing programs, I think it's important for, again, a very strong working together between the province, national, and the municipalities. The number of people who are putting houses in flat plains is unbelievable. And you go and, you know, grieve with everyone. They've lost their houses, they've lost their possessions and so on. They restore the houses in the same place. But they know that there's a problem. And there's no one who's strong enough to say you can't build here. And this is where I think there's a real, real, real challenge which you need to be focusing on. And then, of course, in the villages, land invasion is a big issue. Land invasion is an issue that needs to be dealt with. And again, we need a way of aligning, standardizing the approach to the site. The question of making sites available, for me, it's important. There are many areas, villages, which I know, people didn't have any services, they didn't have anything. All they needed is they just mark the service and then tell us, well, at some point you're going to put a road up here, you're going to put up, electricity and this thing. This is what has caused a lot of people in some areas. They've even brought their own transformers to actually create electricity for themselves. So the issue of rural housing needs a lot of partnership, and we must offer an opportunity for the public to play their role, but encourage them, because there are also problems of unscrupulous land dealers who would sell a plot and then sell it twice and three times and so on, and then you end up with all of these problems. So unless there's integration in these three spheres and with municipalities, you can't deal with those. And at the end of the day, the policy, human settlement policy, is not only about the houses that the government builds. It's also about how people settle. And that's why I think it's important to keep that in mind. Then, last one? Okay. All right. So the last one is the issue of the reformulation of township housing. You know, instead of all these backyard sheds, and by the way, Chairperson, it's not difficult to have 4 RDP houses in one homestead, because the father, who's myself, I own the place where my 4 daughters and 2 sons all want to have their own RDPs, and they qualify, and you can't say no. So they don't have any other land, so Baba gives them spots nearby, and therefore we'll have 4 RDP houses, and there's nothing illegal or corrupt about it. And that part of what we saw in the Eastern Cape. But my point about it is that townships, there are private sector and banks who are even interested in helping to reformulate the structure of the houses. They take one block and take all of those 5 houses that are there, and then agree on how you actually change this thing into a block of flats. And so they co-own. And then instead of using the shacks, then they must actually go to the flats to actually rent them out and get their income. And they are the co-owners, the sectional titles and everything. You can run it like that. If you go to some of the big metropoles, people own a room at the top floor, and all this, all they own is theirs in their own title and their own name. So there's enough space if you go up. There's not enough space on the ground. So I think we need to look at that. And therefore, it brings us also to the last point of, people who are in urban centers particularly, you've got an issue of permanent home and temporary home. I don't want to live in Cape Town. I just want to have a house, which is where I live now. It's a temporary home. It exists. But I don't want to stay here. I only come here during the working hours, and after that, I'm gone home. So a lot of people are like that. So we need to take those into account, because it offers opportunities for more human more housing development. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I would, I don't need to waste your time with my apology for arriving late. The detail I'll explain after. And pardon me if I regurgitate what's already been covered. First of all, I just want to respond to a few issues, starting with the historical account that is being provided in the white paper on the evolution of housing policy and delivery. I don't think it's sufficient to give an account of how apartheid marginalized black people in this sector. I think we should equally, so that there is a complete picture, give an account of how white privilege was rolled out through housing provision, starting from 1910 when the Union of South Africa was made, and that history of almost 100 years, not only of black marginalization, but also of white privilege. If you look at city centers, you would see that all these tall skyscrapers were aimed at providing housing for poor and middle-class white people. And in fact, under the Group Barriers Act, no black person was allowed to occupy. It's only after 1994 that things started shifting. In fact, if you wanted to rent any place in the inner city, you had to get a white friend to sign the lease and then sublet to you. That's why they even introduced a law that said you cannot sublet without the permission of the landlord to curb black influx into urban centers. So it would be assisting. And also, talking about black exclusion, we cannot start in 1922. We have to start in 1913, short of starting in 1910 itself, to talk about how the new union was confronted with the so-called poor white problem after the devastating Anglo-Boer War. So that's where we need to start, so that when we begin to deal with 1994, where we now had to deal with a poor black problem that was artificially created over a period of almost 100 years, we have a comprehensive and contextualized understanding of our history. So that's as far as the historical account in the white paper is concerned. Let's be comprehensive. That's the essence of my input on that one. The second issue is the issue of lawlessness. I disagree with Honorable Horn and a number of Heron, on a number of points that he made. First of all, the Constitution does not dictate the kind of policy on any subject that government should determine. In fact, the Constitution or should take. In fact, the Constitution itself delineates between the different arms of state powers. The power to make law vests in Parliament. The power to adjudicate on those laws vests in the judicial sphere, but the power to determine policy vests in government. So if government says we are not a welfare state but a developmental state, so be it. That is their prerogative to determine the course, the policy course that this country should take. It is their constitutional prerogative. So to begin to question government saying we are not going to create a welfare state and saying it's unconstitutional, where in the Constitution is the concept of a welfare state created? All right? Neither is the concept of the developmental state determined in the Constitution. That is the prerogative of government to determine what the policy vision of the country should be. It's within their constitutional parameters. All right? Now, linked to that is the whole notion of lawlessness. And I agree with a number of colleagues, Honorable Teki, Honorable Advocate, Dr. Mkhize. we cannot build a developmental state that is hinged on tolerating lawlessness. Because where are we going with that? All right? You can't plan anything on a foundation that is flawed, where people just occupy their place. Of course, we have a problem of land hunger, which dates back to 1913, and that's why you cannot exclude the 1913 Act, and the devastation is caused over decades of exclusion of black people from land, right? And to say that it's not good enough to give people land and not provide housing on that land is a fallacy. Because some people don't need your RDP houses. They just need land where they can build their own mansions, poor as they may be. So, I don't know where they get the money and how they save up some deprive themselves of all the pleasures of life to invest in an asset because of what they know, how the physical asset passes on from generation to generation, sustainable, wealth creation. Now, this links to the issue of illegal sale of land or any immovable asset, including RTP houses. Now, the law of property is very clear that when it comes to any other kind of contract, you can enter it in by way of verbally by word of mouth, and that's valid in law as long as you can prove that there was such an agreement. But when it comes to land, the sale of land especially, or any immovable asset on land, that doesn't work. Now, I'm raising this because a lot of people, purely out of ignorance, think that by writing a letter to you and you sign and I sign, land has ownership has been transferred. It hasn't. And then when you die and your heirs come in and they kick out people, and people say, but we paid for this. And they say, well, but there is no valid agreement here. We are the lawful heirs and we're taking the land. And it creates chaos. So please, can we, as we issue title deeds, teach our people that you cannot just transfer ownership of this piece of property without following the law, and therefore when you decide even after the 8 years to sell, let us assist you to do it legally, all right, so that there is order, all right? So the issue of what really are we trying to do in terms of our development planning in relation to housing and the whole concept of human settlements. I agree with the issue that Mr. Heron, of saying, let's really go back to the concept of human settlement in its full context, and make sure that in this white paper we strengthen that area. And I will not elaborate further than what he said. We all know what the expanded definition of human settlement means and what it takes to roll out sustainable human settlements and which role players should come into the picture. I would even go further and say the security cluster should not be excluded. It should not just rest with the social cluster only, because there will always be security issues of illegal hijacking of buildings and all of those kind of issues which need to be addressed as well in a broader collective government endeavor. Chair, in the interest of time, as you asked us to restrain ourselves, let me pause there and hopefully I can raise other issues in future platforms. No, Chair, this one has to come in. Please pardon. The issue of saying that, and my apologies, because have you already dealt with the issue of municipalities capacity? Oh, you haven't dealt with that. All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Masuta. I think the members have made comments. You don't have to respond. Some of these things are input, some of the clarity that you might want to deal with. But I want to caution, or maybe to add to come to the issue of the taking the powers of the HDA. Yeah, because that's where my... Besides the context that the Honorable Peter has put it, but in my view is the HDA, the purpose of its existence was to have a developer of choice that will then frequently intervene and with resources, and land is one of the resources that HDA, for it to be recapitalized and become the developer of choice, they need to have that. So in my own view,
if we need to intervene, particularly in the property development, ADA has to be capacitated such that it can then become that vehicle that assists us to transform and the property industry, and even the and it, you need then to position it such that it then have that muscles to do that. And in terms of the housing code, it's very clear that the minister can intervene in any way. It doesn't stop, but to take the powers of the HDA, that's where I have a problem. But the housing code is very clear that the minister can, on time to time, intervene and prescribe into the issues of the housing policies. So I think maybe we have to get a balance such that we don't killing the HDA. The second issue is the the issue of land invasion. That two paragraph, I agree with Honorable Mthi. We need to strengthen that part. And maybe we should even look at the plumas and the municipal act around the municipal laws that we have in the country that deals with the housing development. You know, this, if you want to have integration, for instance, the way the municipality settles communities they are still perpetuating apartheid system, because you not have, you know, in Polokwane, I was fortunate to head housing. One of the things that I was ushered with was that I had to fight with the municipality that they said we could not build RDP next to Bendo. Bendo is the D suburb. And they're saying that it devalued their houses. So, and it's because municipality, in terms, I don't know what that term they use it, and even affect even the evaluation of the property itself. If you have a beautiful house in the middle of poor houses, when they evaluate the houses, they use the two, those houses, and to determine the price of your house. And yes, so which is a problem as far as I'm concerned. You build a beautiful house, then it will then be determined by these houses that surrounded you. It's a problem. I think we have to look at that, and as we build these policies, we should then be able to address those issues. Those are the two things that I thought I must speak to. And then you can then respond to issues that needed clarity from honorable members, so that we go to the next item.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. And thanks for the members' comments and contributions, as well as clarity-seeking questions. Chair, you are correct. Most of the issues raised are actually inputs to the white paper, and we welcome that. I will therefore not seek to respond to those matters that we should readily note and put in and consider into the incorporation into the paper. But what also came out are some of the few clarity-seeking questions that we would seek to isolate and respond to. At the outset, I think we need to start first with the issue of consultation. It's an issue that has been raised, and where it is said that we seem not to be interested in consulting widely. We are, and I think we have taken to heart the submissions that have been made to us including by a set of NGOs that felt that the December period, being a downward period, was insufficient enough for them to make significant inputs. We, cognizant of that, we did not argue. We didn't even want to raise legalities pertaining to the white paper process. That simply requires us to gazette and ask for comments and wait for the 30 days for the comments to come, consider them and pass on. But we wanted substantive public participatory process, and having heard what was said by the NGOs and knowing very well that the process we were following was nevertheless correct, we still felt that we needed to go beyond that process as prescribed and to engage much more thoroughly. We not only extended the deadline for submissions of written comments, but we doubled actually the number of consultative forums we were planning for, and we also began to expand even to subsector levels within the sector to consult widely. So I think we are committed. I guess the key thing would be that we be much more succinct, we be guided in that manner by the committee as to which other stakeholders, other than what we listed and what we mentioned we're engaging, are we missing out. And that is why we welcome what Honorable Magesele points out to in as far as traditional communities. And I think correctly on that list and consistent with what Dr. Mkhize points out to us, the need for a much more better response to our rural housing approach. We welcome that, and I think in our plans, we will then incorporate those stakeholders into the consultative process. So we are keen. We will not say no, and everybody who has come forward to us to say they wish to engage, we have engaged them. But there are other stakeholders, and I want to assure Honorable Magesele that we aren't only reactive, waiting for people to raise and say we want to talk to you. We have been active in inviting people ourselves and in sharing the paper with them to say, let's talk about it and give us your inputs and this is our thinking and so on. Even within government, I can assure members that we are talking widely. And other than just the clusters as well as the facade that we have tabled the paper at, we are having bilaterals with the department. And we have decided that we will leave the Treasury last. We also discussed with them to say, let's hear all subsector departments first, we will come to you last, and that engagement is scheduled for next week. So we are keen on engaging everybody in this regard to ensure that we succeed. Chair, let me then move to the issue that has been raised, more specifically about what Honorable Mpiti pointed out to. We are on the same page with what Honorable Masuta points out to. We will never pretend to support illegal occupation. We will not do it. I think that we will be firm about it. That is why it is called illegal occupation, and with the emphasis being on illegal. So we are not talking about ordinary occupation here. And where the state has faltered in its responsibility to make sure that it prevents that illegal occupation within the 48 hours as prescribed, then the state has taken responsibility inadvertently for those people who have occupied the land. And therefore, they can no longer be considered in the context of them being illegal occupiers. And therefore, the state has an obligation to provide alternative accommodation for them. And here we are talking about new invasions. We're talking about our capacity, willingness, and political will to prevent illegal occupation from taking place in the first instance. And I think this is where municipalities, ourselves, and provinces have got to get up and be much more robust in our response to prevent, because this robs us of the opportunity to plan ahead and to do what Honorable Huron say we must do. And it then makes us follow the undue patterns of what we shouldn't be following, and it creates even new complications, because often than not, Dr. Mkhize is correct, the land being occupied is unsuitable land. And it is for that very reason in the first instance why it remains vacant. So when it gets occupied, there is no near alternative land in many instances. We have to develop elsewhere, and there is always a refusal of people to move to those faraway communities than where they are located in that instance. And I think this is where the challenge is. And I want to clarify linked to this matter, because the flip side of this coin is where people have actually invaded land that the geotech studies have indicated it is suitable for development. And under that, those circumstances, the reason that it was originally illegally occupied would not be the only reason, and it will not be the only sufficient grounds on why we presume we must develop elsewhere and move people elsewhere. So if that land is found to be suitable, albeit for the original purpose, it was not intended to be a human settlement, but inadvertently because of what has happened and the lapse of responsibility on the part of the state, people were allowed to occupy the area. But now that it is a settlement, albeit being informal, it can be formalized, and we can develop in city and build houses for people where they are already located without having to talk about moving them elsewhere. And I think that at this point, Honorable Mpiti, the horse has already bolted at that point. Land was illegally occupied. There was a lapse on the part of the state to do what it's supposed to do in terms of the law, and inadvertently people are settled. So at that stage, you cannot now be saying our reluctance at relocation of people, and we're saying we will only move them as a point of last resort, but we rather develop where they are already located, means that we are inadvertently supporting illegal occupation. I think that it's far from it. In effect, our viewpoint is that we will not support illegal occupation under any guise, and even where others, which Dr. Mkhize correctly characterized as shack lords and others, who encourage occupation illegally of land, either for votes or for expediency or for money or for whatever they are doing, we should not support that. And I think the state has been blackmailed because of its human rights commitment to accepting what it shouldn't accept. And Honorable Masuta is correct in saying we should show some degree of intolerance to that. And I think the determination and the will is there for us to do that. Let me touch now the other issue that was required for clarification. Was our interest in alternative building technologies? Our current dilemma is the issue that we are committed. There is a policy. It says we should do it. But currently, when we look at how much it costs us with this conventional building materials, and we're looking at each and every single proposal that is accredited by Agrima SA, that shows that these materials are safe, you can build with them, they last, and so on. The cost of building of one unit with these materials almost all the time exceed the cost of what we are working on. And now, if the subsidy is what we give, and these alternatives are coming at a higher rate, where should we be? Because with the budget constraints where we are, the policy choices we must make seems quite pretty. That is, to build one housing unit for the cost of two RDP houses with alternative building technologies, we rather build two houses than one. And I think that there has not been an incentive, so to say, because of the prohibitive cost for the state to latch on to the alternative materials and start ramping them up as much as we can. We have issued a tender in which we are requesting, and we have packed our prices to say that if anyone at all has alternative building technologies that are accredited and approved, both by Agrima and SAPS, and that they can come in at par with the subsidy or below, we are ready. They should come forward. And it closed. There was none inside. No responses. We are reopening it again. And we will make the call, and we'll continuously make that call. And the other alternative was for us to reconsider what then is the subsidy. But we do know now that with the current subsidy to build an RDP house, contractors are still able to build it, and they build it and they still make a profit, and we still have a house. And that's the bottom line of what our benchmark is at now. So I think that that point is important for us to make, because there is a viewpoint that say we talk about it, but we do not actually actualize it. But it's an issue of cost-benefit analysis we're looking at. The other key matter that has been raised, and which we're being asked, are we going to review the quantum, and are we going to review the 3.5 in the housing code? Well, I think I should leave that to the minister. She's about to make her own announcement relative to this matter in a space of 2 weeks. I think that will come out through quite well from what she would say. But in essence, we are alive to what members are raising. It has been the same for a significant period of time, and it has not allowed for much room to do a lot with what we see. There was then an issue raised by Honorable Bratiron, and the issue was that the misalignment in terms of the priorities, and I'm just noting the other parts you mentioned, we welcome, we will deal with them. I'm just highlighting the ones that I think require us to respond to. That misalignment, if we were to only rely on the use of the grant framework to compel with the conditionalities we attach, the reality is that we are only giving right now about only 33 municipalities that are accredited to be able to do some work for us and for provinces in the delivery of houses, because these are the ones that meet with the framework. We are revising that framework, which is what we will present next. But in essence, it's a framework determining for us to be sure that this municipality would be able to do the work it's supposed to. And you would also see that all metros are already accredited in this regard. But of essence is that it is not all. But where an emergency occurs in one area and a municipality chooses its own options elsewhere and says they are within their rights to decide what they do and they are not recipient of our grants, we have no mechanism of actually forcing them to do anything. And I can give even now, where minister did last priority housing areas, that there is no mechanism as we speak to force some of the municipalities to actually consider that and respond adequately to what is being said. And this is a clear lack of power that should be embedded either in policy or in law, so that the ministerial directives in this regard could be observed and be respected. So I think that there is that issue. Then the other issue, Chair, I must give comfort about the HDA. You raised this, and I also had Honorable Mpiti raising this matter. I think we are not a bit dogmatic about the powers of the ministers and what they should be and what they can be. The reality of the matter is that our constitutional system operates on that basis, that they are ministers, and that the ministers are accountable, and that's why they come to Parliament to account on behalf of government and on behalf of the departments they lead. And in this regard, it's not every power that is listed in any act or any other law which is granted to ministers. Many of them across many departments are what would fit the definition of being a technical power. And nevertheless, the ministers perform those powers. But it is intended and it is understood from where it goes that the system is designed in such a manner that there is a department that supports the minister in the execution of such powers. So it isn't that inherently there is something wrong with a person appointed as a minister having power to exercise the power in one way or the other. The issue is the manner in which that power is exercised. And of course, if ministers exercise powers wrongly, there are arbiters in terms of the judiciary that could review those powers. But with us, we are looking at what is practical. There is no wholesale removal of powers of the HDA to a minister. There is only one issue which we experience, HDA experiences it, and all of us agree that it will be better if the minister was the one who received the government properties, immovable properties, because of the provisions of Kiama. It makes it a long-winded process. In any event, the HDA is not able to move on that matter unless it approaches a minister of human settlements. And even DPWI will not listen to HDA without the minister of human settlements coming forth, simply because of how the laws are written and how they are articulated elsewhere. And you would not seek to amend all laws just so that you deal with one administrative process. And I think that is where the issue lies. The HDA will remain what it is. In fact, this move will strengthen and empower it much more than it is now. And it will resolve the backlogs of it being able to access and develop state properties. Right now, HDA can only but watch, looking at the property in the inner city being vandalized and dilapidated. And its access to that property takes forever, whereas if the power sets with the minister, it could be easily transferable, and then the minister has a direct line function of that because it's easier for us to delegate functions from our parent department to our own entities via the shareholder contracts we're signing and the transfer payments agreements we're signing vis-a-vis how HDA is an entity of our own parent department has to interact with another department. This is practicality, and I don't think that we should fear the streamlining of efforts from a lived experience to make it much more better and much more resilient in terms of the system. And I think that is, unless I'm missing any other key issue that was an issue for clarity, I thought that the rest of them were the issues of inputs and others required further work on them. And the only issue I will just raise in my concluding remarks will be on the system around beneficiaries. This matter, several members raised it. It's an important issue even for us. The HSS, I can tell you, that it has its own limitations. You advocate for transparency of it. No doubt we are committed to that, and that is why those who venture into calling our offices to try and find out where they are on the HSS, we indulge them. We have even set up a small call center to receive this type of calls and to respond to our people in as far as those who want to know, am I on the list, and if I am, what number am I, and so on. But HSS, like I said, has its inherent limitations. It's an archaic system. It's more than 10 years old, or actually more than 15 years old. It's not what it should be. It's not on the cutting edge. It cannot be mobile. It can't be downloaded. It can't be. So, and even the push technologies cannot work on the system. It is quite archaic. And it will also not do what Honorable Huron saying it must do, that we ought to know the housing needs of the people who are on our list. What are they qualifying for? And that inadvertently will help us plan better for them. But this what is there, we can tell you what ages they are, and we can also tell you whether they are male or female. But I guess that's about how far we will take the information and the data on the HSS is on. But technology has moved so much, even within government. And just take the IEC, what you are able, many of you are politicians, have gone out during the registration weekend, and you have seen what their technology is able to do. Remote registrations, people are able to check themselves and confirm that they are on the system, they can check their voting district, and inadvertently the back office of the system is also able to tell them what Fama Mabula was reporting hardly a day after registration weekend has closed. He was addressing on a Monday, and he was telling people how many young people have registered, how many. The system had already disaggregated all the data. So there is no reason why we, human settlements, in this day and age, we are in the technological dark ages we're in. There's no reason why we shouldn't be having a push-talk system that can help us, and the technologies that are readily available and for the beneficiaries, and also the back office of many of our policies. And we're working on that, and I think It's among the biggest priorities Minister has given to me, and also put it quite high with a heavy weighting in my performance agreement. And I think we are committed to making sure that we bring this to life before the end of this year. We should be ready to have a system that will be able to do this, and for once and for all, be able to have a workable system whenever you ask us. Even without asking us, you can log in yourselves and just check and see what's happening, and we can talk clearly about beneficiaries. And this will eliminate the issues that have been raised. People who have gotten a stand in this municipality, but next week they get a house elsewhere. And people who now are simply not beneficiaries staying in the properties, they all of that the system can actually address for us. Thank you very much, Chair.
Apologies. Thanks for indulging me. It will be very quick. First of all, I just want to reinforce the point that a minister derives executive authority, which is original authority, from the Constitution itself. The first thing that a president does when he assumes executive authority over the state is to allocate and delineate portfolios and functions to different ministers. So everything that happens under that portfolio, whether it's entities within that portfolio or the department itself, is the ultimate responsibility of that minister, period. And when anybody sues the department or an entity, the first respondent is the minister. And everybody else can be cited under the minister, except where the law or the constitution itself gives original powers, say, to a DG like a PFMA, where ministers cannot perform certain functions like procurement. Ministers, it's a no-no to get involved there. But everything else, their prerogative. And secondly, Chair, I don't think it's sufficient to say we, out of the 200 and X municipalities, we accredit only 31 municipalities or so to deliver houses. What about communities in the rest of the municipalities? If you go to Grootboom case, which is one of the earliest cases in socioeconomic rights, back in 1998, I think it was, it says the responsibility rests with all three spheres of government to provide adequate housing under the Constitution. So it's not sufficient to say, well, if a municipality cannot deliver, there has to be a situation where if a municipality can do it, then national can do it. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks, Chair. I thought we coming to the presentation of accreditation of the municipality.
I was simply reacting, Chair, to what the DG had said. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair. You know, it's very nice to be an advocate to analyze everything. So when I grew up, Honorable Mashita, I wanted to do law because I like the way people of law, they don't just agree, you have to convince them. No, thank you very much, Honorable Masut and DG for the response. I think that there is no transmesh. We welcome the input. Can we then move to the second item? I don't see whether we'll manage in terms of the time. Members are expected to be in the city hall at 2 o'clock. I'm going to request that maybe we can have a presentation. If it's then we'll populate questions. Then at the next meeting we then get the response if members to allow.
Agreed.
Thank you very much.
Highlight the key features of the policy.
Thank you. Sorry. So I'm already guided towards what I was going to propose anyway, that perhaps I'd be allowed through you, Chair, to cut the first 13 slides because they deal with the historical background, while the nature of the business why we are here is to present the accreditation framework. The historical background naturally deals with the issues why some of the issues that has led us to revising this framework. So I'll collapse it. I'll just give a high level of the historical background in terms of defining the nature of the problem. So I will then go into the revised accreditation framework, which is the our business of the day. But allow me, Chair, to summarize the 30 places I've alluded to. The accreditation framework is established through Section 10 of the Housing Act, which empowers the National Minister to set up norms, standard criteria, as well as the process through which municipalities can be accredited. So it set up a process through which province can be able to delegate this function to the municipality. And prior the approval of the of this revised accreditation framework, which was approved by MINMEC on the 15th of September 2023, as well as endorsed by cabinet in December 2023, we've been using what we call National Accreditation and Assignment Framework of 2012. The reason why there was such a need to actually have a fundamental or a paradigm shift and move from the accreditation framework of 2012 was precisely based on the foundational policy intent of 2012. The 2012 accreditation framework was based on the premise that as you accredit the municipality, you need to be able to then shift the function to the municipality permanently. That was the serious bone of contention in terms of some of the problems that were encountered in terms of implementing the accreditation program. One of the reasons was that it did not receive popular support from the provincial MECs. Because in provinces like Gauteng, for example, it means that you are going to take 84% of the budget that sits with the province and permanently give it to the municipality. So one of the issues which were raised by then was the state of local government. That, and is it that risky enough that we permanently move the function to the municipalities? But also added to that, Chair, was the issue around the fact that we have only accredited 35 municipalities, as the accreditation of this municipality did not receive much popular support from the provincial space. But suffice to also mention that the policy intent of the accreditation program, as well as the objectives, were not pretty much fully achieved. Reason being that the accreditation implementation protocol, which formalizes the accreditation transaction between the delegating authority, which is the province, and the municipalities, were not signed. Therefore, a lot of these municipalities were not performing the function. It was just accreditation in paper. We have therefore picked up, we've done our study in terms of what are some of the policy gaps which the accreditation framework did not address. We've taken some of those lessons into this new accreditation framework that we are presenting today. What is this accreditation framework that we are presenting today? It must be understood within the ambit of developmental state as well as developmental local government. Its premise is on collaborative and coordination effort across all spheres of government in terms of delivery of human settlement. It's also built in to ensure the whole issue around vertical and horizontal integration. There's been, from the beginning of this meeting today, members as well as DG and our DDG and even Minister before she left, has highlighted the issue around the lack of integration of planning across all spheres. So one of the fundamental issues that which the accreditation framework seeks to achieve is to ensure that there's integration across all spheres of government in terms of infrastructure planning, in terms of planning itself, either fiscal or spatial planning, so that we can be able to address the issue around the apartheid spatial planning. I must also indicate the fact that this is an intensive consulted document where all the critical stakeholders within the sector or beyond the sector were involved. I'm talking about DPME, I'm talking about National Treasury, I'm talking about COFTA, I'm also talking about provinces, municipalities, as well as... So this is a collective wisdom of the sector and beyond the sector in terms of the inputs that were made. What is it that we're proposing in terms of the accreditation framework? The accreditation framework introduces six thrust or pillars, which will then be able to assist us in terms of implementing the delegation of the housing function or allow the municipalities to be able to play a role and actively participate in development of housing and human settlement. The first pillar or the first track is around program-based incremental approach. This accreditation framework recognizes the fact that municipalities will differ in terms of their capacity, in terms of their housing needs. So it's considered that the municipality can be accredited based on one program that is relevant to the needs of that municipality, and you can incrementally then build the capacity of a municipality to take much more housing function or much more or added function of programs that the municipality can be able to develop the capacity on. The other second thrust, which is a fundamental shift, or we are moving to a second generation of municipalities. The first framework has highlighted the focus and the prioritization of the accreditation of metros. We have all metros accredited at level 2, and yet this is a very important level of municipality, which is secondary or intermediate cities, which now in terms of this accreditation framework says we need to be able to focus and go to the second level of generation of municipalities so that they get accredited. We have adopted at least 39 municipalities in terms of the list that has been published by COGDA. Some of these municipalities, or perhaps just to go a little bit back, we have recognized the fact that the same challenges that metros are encountering, in actual fact, the secondary or intermediate cities are actually encountering. And we've been able to give a support towards the metros in terms of the USDG, in terms of the CSP program, city support program that's designed to actually capacitate and help municipalities to develop human settlement. So we're now saying that level of support needs to be able to go to the second tier or to the second level of municipalities, which is intermediate cities, so that they can be able to deal with the issues around spatial planning and integration of planning, but also deal with the issues around rapid urbanization, which actually manifests itself in terms of the mushrooming of informal settlement, aging infrastructure, and we also see that some of these municipalities are barely able to collect. So we need to be able to assist them to be able to increase their revenue base and their capacity to be able to collect so that they can be able to have a budget to deal with basic service obligation that they're expected to, but also to be able to assist them to deal with undesirable audit outcomes that gets published through the Auditor General. What are some of these municipalities? I've spoken about this. We've got about 39 municipalities across the country. We've adopted this list from COGDA in terms of their IUDF program. This then tells you that we're going to have a collaborative effort. We're going to harmonize some of these packages that we have with COGDA so that we can have a far much more impact around the municipalities, so that we don't just focus on our human settlement mandate. We need to be able to deal with COVID. So perhaps you might be asking yourself, what are some of these red colors. Let me just go through it a little bit quicker. So this lead we adopted from COPTA, but it also comes from the state of local government report that COPTA publishes annually. In terms of that report, some of these municipalities, the red color there represent municipalities that are dysfunctional. The amber color there represent the municipalities whose status is at a level of medium risk, while the green color, the green color where you have Umhlathuze and other municipalities represent the municipalities that are classified as low risk, while the municipality, the green color there where you see Stellenbosch, represent a stable municipality. So we've also classified what are some of the government initiatives that are sitting in some of these municipalities. Where you see L1 or L2, it means that these are the municipalities that are presently accredited. One of those some of those municipalities are accredited at level 1 if you see L1. Where you see L2, it means that those municipalities are accredited at level 2. I'll then explain what level 1 and level 2 mean. So what are some of the interventions that we're going to do as National Department in this municipality? There's presently an accreditation drive that we have begun to implement in terms of getting all these municipalities preparing them to be able to get to a level where they get accredited. It's a level of preparation, highly intensive preparation that goes into that. But we're also going to ensure that the ones that are accredited at least maintain the level of accreditation. We're able to support them so that they don't lose the level of accreditation that is awarded to them. Remember that this delegation is conditional. It doesn't mean that once the municipality receives the delegation, it's permanent. It's conditionally based on the fact that the municipality will live up to its obligation. Where the municipality digresses or violates the condition under which it's accredited, that accreditation can be withdrawn. Then moving on, let me not sit on this slide because I think I've touched on it. What some of the packages? We have designed packages. For an example, dysfunctional municipalities that are non-accredited, with design packages for municipalities that are accredited at level 1 so that they can move at level 2. We have design packages and support to these municipalities that are accredited at level 2 so that they don't lose their accreditation. We'll then define this level of accreditation through the individual. So we're going to zoom into each and every municipality, undertake an assessment of some kind, and then come up with a capacity support plan that talks to the institutional or capacity gaps into those municipalities. The third pillar under which accreditation will be implemented that were put forward is around the issue about the timeline. Previously, in terms of the previous accreditation framework, it will take about 3 to 4 years for a municipality to get accredited from a level where the application of the municipality is received by a province, and then province send that accreditation application to us. We have now slashed that 5 years by a period at least of 30 days, that from the time when the application of the municipality is received by National, we are able to respond and assess the municipality and be able to give the municipality the report whether the municipality meets the criteria or not. But we have also imbued the accreditation process. Before that, I had actually promised that I'm going to define what the accreditation levels. Sorry? Did I pass? Okay. The level of accreditation, there are two levels of accreditation. There's level one, which is the foundational stage of accreditation. A municipality can get accredited largely to do beneficiary management and beneficiary administration. While level two, on top of the level one functions, the municipality can be able to package and implement housing programs. Mm-hmm. It will depend on whether the municipality get accredited for one or two, a mixture of those accreditation programs. But another thing that we have expanded is the issue around the criteria under which these municipalities are going to be assessed and awarded accreditation. MINMEC had impressed on us that it, the municipality, for a municipality to get accredited, they, it must actually work hard. It's not an automatic entrance that each municipality can just get accredited through an application. They have to go through a very tight assessment criteria. One of the areas that which we look at is the issue around integrated planning, whether the municipality has the capacity and the ability to be able to develop a human settlement sector plan that can be adopted by council, whether the municipality is able to deal or develop and establish what we call a capital investment framework and ensure that that capital investment framework gets implemented. We also are looking at the issues around sound governance and administration. So we'll zoom in terms of the positive audit outcomes. What is the Auditor General saying in terms of the good governance in that municipality? We consider that. But we also look at the issues around program and project management. We look in terms of what is it that the municipality presently doing in terms of the grants that is allocated to it. Is it spending? Is it able to deliver on its mandate? So we also consider issues around the ability of the municipality and the capability of municipality to deal with the issues of beneficiary management, zooming into the issues around the National Housing Register. We also look at the issues around reporting, et cetera, et cetera. But far much more above it, we also have imbued the criteria with the state of local government indicators that we have adopted from COGDA. Because we are not only accrediting the housing unit of the municipality, we are accrediting the municipality in its entirety. So it's important that we look at the health of the municipality in its entirety. I've spoken about the issue of the accreditation process, which we have shortened by a large amount. Let me not sit there. The fourth thrust or pillar, it's around financial resourcing of this municipality. We'll remember that if municipalities are implementing housing program, it's an unfunded mandate. So we need to ensure that as we accredit or give this municipality programs, we also choose in them in terms of the operational funding that comes with the level of accreditation that they are awarded. But we also ensure that the issues around accountability are actually infused into this accreditation framework. We are saying that the municipality, before it gets accredited, it must actually have a separate account, which will then deal with the issues of the HSDG as it gets accredited, so that it doesn't, the money that gets allocated to the municipality does not get lost somewhere in the big accounts of the municipality. And we are saying that such an account should be a non-interest-bearing account, so that the municipality can be able to spend that money, and we have linked it with the payment schedule, which is based on the performance of the municipality. And we're also stating the fact that there's been a tendency from other provincial departments where they give a municipality a developer status without a municipality being accredited. We're saying as part of this accreditation framework that is prescribed, all the municipalities that are given a human settlement function must be assessed and must be awarded an accreditation status. In terms of the thrust or pillar number five, we are saying that the implementation of the accreditation framework will largely depend on the capacity that's sitting with the provinces, because they are the delegating authority. And in terms of the previous implementation of 2012 framework, because of the lack of support of that framework, some of the provinces have begun to establish accreditation unit. In terms of this, we are saying they must be able to reestablish those accreditation units so that the accreditation business can be taken forward. But we also have another layer where we say the capacity support of the municipality should not just end with the municipality getting accredited. It should be an ongoing an issue. Before the municipality get accredited, when municipality is accredited, we need to ensure that the capacity that is there and the municipality gets supported, and at some other stages they are given a hand to be able to implement projects and programs. Around the issue of, which we've all been decrying, is around the issue of consequence management and accountability. We're saying as part of this accreditation framework, as we accredit this municipality, we need to ensure that they account for a level of accreditation that they are awarded. We will do monthly performance reviews as well as quarterly performance reviews as well as IP reviews, which should be done yearly. We've also have infused some of the strengthened some of the monitoring systems or mechanisms that we have used before. But it's important to stress that the national minister takes the overall responsibility of municipal performance as well as provincial performance on the issue of delivery of human settlement. But we're also saying that as a delegating authority, the MEC must take responsibility on monitoring the performance of the municipality. We've also included issues around remedial action. I think we've spoken about the issue around the curtailing of the time spent in terms of implementation of the accreditation application. What happens if, for example, an application is with national and national does nothing about it? What happens when a municipality put an application to a provincial space and there seems to be no movement? We're putting remedial actions in terms of dealing with that. But not only that, it also moves into the assessment of the municipality as well as when the municipality is implementing the programs that has been delegated to it. If it happens that, because if it happens that the province does not play its role in terms of gazetting, in terms of making sure that money is transferred to the municipality in time, what is that we're going to do? We have also included those remedial actions. But we're also saying that because of the intergovernmental nature of the program, there's bound to be disputes that will arise. We've also infused a mechanism on how to deal with some of these disputes, and we've also attached timelines and the process on how to deal with them, and we also elevated the role of the minister in terms of intervening so that those disputes can be dealt with in time before an explosion. Well, I've alleged the fact that this is a conditional, accreditation is a conditional delegation of the function of a function to a municipality. We've also set in the conditions under which such status of accreditation can be withdrawn, some of which is when the municipality consistently fails to meet the target, it's when the municipality fails to comply, it's when the municipality fails to capacitate itself to be able to take on the function, it's when there's a misuse and a mismanagement of funds that are allocated to the municipality. But we also set out the process. It cannot be done haphazardly. We have set up the process in terms of when can this process be done and the accountability mechanism on how the withdrawal can be done. It's not an issue that the MEC can work up and say I'm withdrawing accreditation in that municipality. There's a legal process that needs to be followed. And where are we in terms of the implementation of the accreditation program since the MINMEC approval and endorsement by Cabinet? We have workshopped all the ICMs. I'm talking about secondary cities. We have further consulted all the critical stakeholders in terms of their key responsibilities. We are now at the level where we are receiving implementation plans from provinces in terms of how are they going to implement and support some of these municipalities. We have further consulted with COGDA and National Treasury so that we have a collaborative effort and we harmonize some of the capacity packages that are sitting in these State Department so that we can have a far much more lasting impact. We also have drafted individual capacity support based on the state of local government report that I've shared in terms of those blue and in terms of what some of these municipalities are lacking. We've already received as part of this accreditation framework, we already received an application for Buffalo City to be accredited at level 2, because it's the only metro municipality that has been accredited at level 1. We have also received an application or an intention for an application to be placed at a later stage from Garden Route Municipality. We have done some assessment of it. We are presently undertaking road shows. We have done Gauteng, Eastern Cape. At the time when we were submitting this report, we had already actually now covered Mpumalanga, we have covered KZN, we have also covered Northwest. Tomorrow we'll be with Northern Cape, and we'll be able to conclude the other provinces in the coming week. And the second level of road shows will be going to municipalities themselves, but we are open also to other invitations. We already have an invitation to go to council in Mirafong municipality to be able to present this. So we just here to for the Human Settlement Portfolio Committee to note the accreditation framework, which was approved by MINMEC as well as endorsed by Parliament, as well as note the implementation to date of the revised accreditation framework. Thank you very much. I hope I was covered the issues speaking. By cabinet. My apologies. By cabinet. By cabinet. My apologies. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Msongo. Members, as we have agreed, populate the question, and then we'll then give the department time to go and respond, and in the next meeting they'll come, they'll start with them. Let's have that, those that want to ask questions. Yes, so that can they get recorded. Okay. Honorable Seki, Honorable Masuta, Honorable Makasin. Okay.
Sure. I think here we need to note the status of municipality, even the status of the province. Chair, conditional grants are allocated every year, but there are problems every year. Now, this could be a good decision by MINMEC, although I hear the contestation of moving it from the province straight to municipality. And one understands. It goes back to a question of, are we developing human settlement or we are developing housing? But that's another discussion. I see the criteria, but I'm not sure whether, to me, it's still lacking the actual reality of municipality in terms of performance financially and otherwise. So I get to engage as much, but that's my worry. All I could ask maybe for the department to do, can they be very specific on the criteria? Let it not be as, okay, in my view, what I see here, it's quite general. Let me make an example. The municipality in 2024, in the normal language, we say, like, what is happening in Tshwane now? There's money that is returned to the treasury. this municipality could anyhow justify or qualify to receive a grant to build houses. In my view, that's a no. Even if it's not about housing, that's just general performance. It should be included in the criteria of assessing the municipality. The municipality has been having an MM acting for 12 months. Could we send this to that municipality? There's no stability. The municipality is under administration. You know, all those things, in my view, they are quite serious here for granting. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. when SAS calls you, you drop everything and listen to them. Apologies for earlier. The issue that I had raised earlier with the DG around this capacity question of municipalities, I will not dwell much further on it. I hope the point is taken that the responsibility ultimately is shared between all three spheres. So whatever framework you create, the Constitution and the Constitutional Court has clarified that issue in Grootboom. You have all three spheres of you a collective responsibility. So if a municipality does not meet your criteria for accreditation, it does not absolve you of the responsibility to make sure that those communities in those areas of municipalities that are not accredited, between yourself and province, somebody is got to reach out to those communities and ensure that they too enjoy equal rights as South African communities, equal to all other communities. And in particular, I would begin to understand how the Department of Rural Development, Agriculture, etc., has been roped in around the specific question of rural development in relation to human settlements. You know all the complexities. You can't even talk about spatial planning or what do you call it, declaration of townships there. Much of it is tribal authority land, and you know what the law says about communal land. You cannot issue separate title deeds in those lands. There's only one title deed, which is held by the traditional authority, and that's it. But there are occupational rights that the courts over the years have clearly articulated, and I won't go into all of that. But we clearly need to understand what is our development strategy in rural communities with specific reference to your portfolio on human settlements, all right, with all the issues that I will not detail in full. So that's the one set of issues which I really want to see how you are dealing with, complex as they may be. The issue of spatial integration and doing away with apartheid spatial planning lines has its own complications when it comes to undoing some of that. The chair has also alluded to the whole question of, you know, you developing RDP sort of development, which is essentially by definition low cost in the middle of high cost settings. What is your policy perspective on that? Because you need to be decisive there. Do you want to reduce value of high value assets purely because you want to push the idea of spatial integration, or you want to acknowledge, in the plane, the business class and the economy class, business class, you pay more to get more. So let's get the politics right there. Let's not over-exaggerate things. Put things in context. That's as far as I'll say, as far as that is concerned. So I really, going forward, would want to understand, because I thought that the establishment of entities within the department was precisely to enable you at National to be able to deliver and plug gaps in areas where municipalities or provinces might not have the capacity, the will, or the resources to actually roll out human settlements, where you then come in with your entities to plug those gaps. But beyond that, Chair, I think in the interest of time, let me pause there. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I just want to check the issue of Ekurhuleni. The last time the department came to the committee, the Ekurhuleni was still in level 2. When was being Ekurhuleni accredited to level 3? Because the last time it was not yet accredited to level 2 when they were here. I heard about BCM, but also the Ekurhuleni, I think there were last year some challenges on that. So there are municipalities also that are already accredited that we know they don't meet criteria, like the one that went in oversight in King Sabata Dalinya. If that municipality again, the status of that municipality is still the same, are they able to withdraw? Because I know I am aware they presented something that now they can withdraw. What is the status of that municipality? Although they put them in a nice color, a little bit amber, because they were supposed to be in the red, because that municipality on the issue of housing, I don't think they qualify to be in that car. So I just want to check, what are they doing with those municipalities that already they give you problem before you took this list from COCTA just to implement? You can do your own investigation, because the status of the municipality, we all know, sitting in this committee, some of the municipalities, literally, they are dysfunctional, although you want to accredit them.
Thank you. What I haven't quite picked up is that you would consider accrediting a district municipality. And I'm more interested in the fact that we're supposed to assist the capacity building in a district municipality. So where you've got either rural or small towns where none of them are capable of handling the human settlement issue, would it not assist to actually build capacity? You know, COCTA has got the outfit called MISA, which helps to build degree of capacity. And amongst the projects that it could be focusing on is to build capacity so that you, together with the municipality, can actually, you know, build that capability of each district municipality to manage human settlement issues. I think in the long term, following the model that we're using, we should be seeing a situation where your district municipality becomes the main center of coordination, control, and infrastructural development right across the district, and therefore this becomes a worthwhile investment to build future partnership. So I just would like to get your comment on that.
Thank you.
Maybe you also thought we were going to talk a lot. Why don't we allow the department to respond now?